with Rebecca Hargraves and Devin Stack.
Hey, hey!
Welcome to Outlaws. Sorry about last week, guys. We had a conflict, a scheduling conflict. I'm sure you talked about this on Insomnia Stream, but yeah, and I was so sick, so it doesn't really matter. And I did the Christian White podcast, so check that out.
Well,
but we are back.
We're back and better than ever. We have a deeper topic than I was expecting when I first started looking into it. Started off as just a simple Wikipedia entry, and then it exploded into like a, what? I don't remember any of this happening.
I guess neither do I. But, and we were looking for some of the clips, and they've been just completely scrubbed from the internet. I spent an hour today looking for this one clip. It was a 2020 episode with Barbara Walters. It does not exist on the internet.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think something like that would exist because it's not like a small interview. I mean, it was really big at the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, we do have a lot to go through. I'm Devin Stack, by the way. And
I'm Rebecca Hargraves.
You're watching Outlaws, and we're going to get right into it here. So let's see here. Ba-bump. All right, this guy is who we're going to be talking about. Look at him.
Ira Einhorn.
With a name like that and a face like that. Actually, this guy pulled chicks somehow. This guy was a ladies' man. And
High quality boy. He wouldn't go after the Jewish chicks. What a surprise.
No. And he was very important. He was very important to the Jewish movement, also known as the Civil Rights Movement or the hippie movement of the 1960s and 1970s. Friends with people like Abby Hoffman, who was the Jew that I've done streams on. If you've seen Forrest Gump, the guy with the American flag shirt going Viet fucking Nam, that's supposed to be Abby Hoffman. All the turbo Jews of the 1960s, this guy was one of them. He was out of Philly. Here's a little intro for those of you who are unfamiliar with him. Let me play this here.
He was a leader in the counterculture movement, dropping acid, protesting the Vietnam War, and organizing Philadelphia's first Earth Day.
Occasionally I look, and I like what I see.
Ira was a combination of Abby Hoffman and Allen Ginsberg and hippie statesmen all rolled into one.
Oh, so wise words. Boop, 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 boop. Yeah, using his big Jew brain there to mesmerize the goy crowd with his Morse code. He was like programming them with some kind of Morse code, I think.
Yeah, see, when you're on LSD, you think that anything anybody says is profound. That's probably why he had such an incredible following.
Absolutely. And he was there to remake the American culture into what boomers, I guess, helped usher into the world that we all grew up in. Here they are gushing over him. Oh, he's such a big brain Jew.
Just like Ira Einhorn, the hippie movement was Jewish Earth Day.
So, yeah, he was a co-founder of Earth Day, and he was well-liked by all the sophisticates of the time. He was one of the top speakers, although the current Earth Day people try to act as if he had nothing to do with it now because, well, you'll find out why.
Yeah, he was a co-founder. He was a professor. He had actual academic standing. People followed him. It was like a cult-like following.
He was considered a guru by many.
Yes.
And South Park did an episode kind of basing their Earth Day, one of their Earth Day characters off of him. So here's that.
The heads of the Earth Day brainwashing organization are here to tell you all about it.
Hello, children. I know you're all very excited about having the Earth Day brainwashing festival put on in your town. Global warming is going to kill us all. The Republicans are responsible.
hell. Yeah, so just to get that out of the way.
That was real subtle. I like it.
Yeah, sponsored by Antelope Hill, of course, obviously. So, so the hippie movement's in full swing in the 1960s, bleeding into the 1970s. And he's one of the top dogs. He's traveling, you know, to San Francisco, to the whole, you know, hippie movement that's exploding over there. And, you know, just very, very, very big guy on the scene. Although you haven't heard him these days, and you'll find out again, find out why.
And he was doing all the standard hippie boomer stuff, like orgies, LSD. He was doing it all.
Well, yeah, and promoting it as a way of life while never having an actual real job. Mm-hmm. Here's one of his Jewish friends.
Yeah, he was wildly wealthy.
Oh, yeah. Without having a real job, he somehow had tons of money. We'll get to that, too. Here's one of his sophisticated Jewish friends talking about how smart he was.
Ira was, like, out there. He was a very experimental kind of guy, and I respected him for that. And he was a man before his time.
He became a sort of an icon of the counterculture here because he represented everything that was going on at that time, from political activism to drugs and various other particular kinds of subjects that became the core of the counterculture rebellion.
Yeah, with wisdom like that, it's hard to imagine how he wasn't, you know, one of the most popular voices on the left. So yeah, he was considered an ultra leftist. And but it's funny because with all these good things to say, you know, that Jews have to say about them, they also have, you know, kind of an unusual thing that they have, and they all do. They all say this. They all have. It's a bit odd. Have you heard this? Did you notice the same sort of a thing when you were doing the research? That they all had this one characteristic about him that they would all bring up. Lovingly.
He loved to be seen in public, particularly talking to people who looked important. And the university was like, again, his home, his public home. This is the student union area where he would give his free university lectures, or he would meet people. You know, you could not miss Ira, because Ira, the way he looked and the way he smelled.
He smelled. I mean, it's really as simple as that. Ira had terrible body odor.
You know, this is just a manifestation of his narcissism, right? I think that he was trying to cultivate this persona. Like, people would note, because he's so ugly, you know, that people would notice when he walked into a room immediately. And that's why he did it. We have a clip, but he was actually not a dirty guy. He bathed.
Yeah, well, and he would sit in his bathtub all day. In fact, he would hold court, I guess you could say, while in his bathtub. In some of the reenactments I found from these weird 90s shows that covered it, they were really bad. All the acting was terrible. They would have him in the bathtub, like, while surrounded by hippies, and he's, like, in the bathtub with, like, a fucking typewriter, while, you know, preaching to the hippies in his bathroom. And but they try to make the excuse, oh, he wasn't stinky because he was a dirty Jew.
That Ira spent about 2 to 3 hours every day bathing. He would spend hours in the bathtub, conduct business from the bathtub, had a phone. He was absolutely pristine clean, but he never cleaned his clothes. And he would put on this mantle of garments that were almost like going out in the world. He needed a scent that was other than his own. It was a persona. Ira did things to shock people.
Look at that guy. Imagine that stinky ass motherfucker just rolling on in. So I don't know. I guess the excuse was, oh no, he wasn't a dirty Jew. He was just a clean Jew with dirty laundry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all it was. Practically lived in a bathtub. Oh, I'll tell you, he was perfectly clean, this Jew. How dare you say that he's dirty?
Did you watch the terrible movie with Naomi Watts?
No, I have it, but I didn't get around to it because it was just so long.
It was awful.
Did they go over the dirty part that he was stinky?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was stinky. But, you know, goy actor and stuff, of course, they didn't touch it.
Yeah. Yeah, no one touches this with a 15-foot pole, the fact that he's Jewish. Or that all of his friends, but like if you'll notice all these people that they're interviewing, like everyone's Jewish, like literally everyone, unless they're, again, no spoiler alert, unless they're part of law enforcement, that's all I'm going to say. they're Jewish. Like everyone involved with this story is Jewish. But
everybody's just talking about his aura. And
right.
His musk and his aura. That's what everybody had to say about Ira.
Right. Now, in today's terms, it was all about aura. It was like he was an influencer, big-brained influencer that everyone thought, had not just aura, but, he had skills with the ladies. He was pulling chicks somehow, even with his stinky Jew clothes. He was still able to, riz them up, apparently. But everyone agreed he did have an egomaniac, or he was an egomaniac. He was definitely a narcissist, but he had the exact same characteristics as like these narcissist influencers that think that I am the movement, that kind of a thing. So
who could you be talking about?
I don't know. Just some fucking, maybe a gay Mexican snitch or something like that. But,
so pissed off on your stream on Friday.
I hate snitches. I fucking hate snitches. I hate snitches. But, anyway, not that I already didn't have reason to be angry, but the snitching thing is just—it's like, come on,
wouldn't you say snitches get stitches?
Well, they do get stitches.
Yeah, but you wouldn't say it on your stream.
Well, I was trying to get other people to see. It's more powerful if they conjure up the second half of the sentence in their own head. Then they think they came up with the idea.
Oh, for a while, I was like, did he legitimately forget this?
No, I forget. Everyone knows snitches get stitches. But, they get stitches, and then they get left in ditches with the rest of the bitches. I mean, who doesn't know that?
Oh, I've never heard that.
Who doesn't know that? So, this guy has a lot of similar qualities, where he had these people that followed him around, like cult members, and thought that every stupid shit that he said was amazing. He was just like this. He was going to be the new leader of the youth, and everyone believed it.
He was really a very egomaniacal person. And as a result, it was very powerful and very seductive and very compelling.
Yeah, I don't understand why. Obviously he was super charismatic. By the way, I'm not just keep playing that clip for the funds. It's like there's not a whole lot of clips of what he actually said.
That's true. And I read some of the stuff that he's written. He wasn't particularly intelligent, but he did this thing that Jews do to get goy women, where you build social credibility because women view it as a sign of status. Like, and that's why he liked to be seen with these other people, because he'd be like, I'm of the same caliber as these people, although he didn't actually have any skills. He wasn't articulate or intelligent. And that is how he got the women. He didn't really have...
He was a clout chaser.
Money. He was a clout chaser. That's exactly right.
No, that's the thing. He was literally a clout chaser with no discernible values and or scruples. Maybe some modern day influencers, right? And he considered himself the brains of every operation that he was a part of. In fact, that's kind of like the deflection that Earth Day does, where they say, well, he might have been there and spoke most of the time, and it was kind of his idea, but he didn't help found Earth Day. He just took it over. He just took it over because he's an egomaniac. I mean, he was an egomaniac. He never had a real job and just considered himself like the center of everything, of the universe.
He didn't have a job. His job was Ira. And Ira, in that context, was to be in everything, to be aware, to be active, to talk to people, to convince them about how important he was and how intelligent he was.
So intelligent. Oh boy, so intelligent, that guy. Just like in the same way that a lot of these influencers are narcissists, and they think that they are the movement, and everything's about them, and they and that does attract a certain kind of person. It does attract people who are weak-willed and kind of stupid and have no ideas of their own, and or will of their own, and they're just looking for a daddy, you know, to tell them what to do. That's the kind of person that he was attracting, and there was a lot of the people like that. In fact, ironically, if you came from, I think, and this, you know, as you'll see, there might be something to this. If you came from a conservative background or like an authoritarian background, you might be even more attached to someone like this because you went from one house where you were, you know, when you were a kid being told what to do all the time to another environment where you're getting told what to do all the time and you never really have to think for yourself. So that's, you know, that's kind of what was going on, I think, with this and a lot of cult type, groups. But just like a lot of these cult type groups, once it becomes clear to powerful people that you have influence over a large group, you now actually do have some value to the rich and famous people because now you can be controlled opposition.
Yes.
You can be working for these, you know, the very, in the case of Ira, you know, who was very anti-establishment, or so he would say, and very anti-corporation and very anti-government, well, you know, he could make a lot of money working with the establishment and major corporations and the government as a kind of a liaison secretly in the background, which might explain where some of his money was coming from, because... You know, this guy wasn't receiving super chats back then, you know, like he's just lecturing people from his bathtub or like from the steps of, you know, some school building at Yale or something like that.
Yeah.
But he's also getting connected to really big corporations and local and even national political figures.
Yeah, he ran for mayor in Philadelphia, didn't he?
Yeah, he ran against Frank Rizzo, which I thought was funny. Fans of the Jerky Boys might know. You know, yeah, it's Frank Rizzo. Frank Rizzo was an actual police chief, but he ran against Frank Rizzo for mayor, and obviously lost. But you know, so he was part of the. It was part of, I guess, increasing his profile. You know, running the mayoral campaign with no intention of actual or chance of winning.
Einhorn's visibility as the city's most prominent counterculture leader led to an unusual alliance. He became a consultant for large corporations, acting as their liaison to the youth movement in Philadelphia.
On one hand, people said, oh my God, this guy, there's something about him. The smell is too much. But on the other hand, dignitaries would sit through it and be fascinated by him. I mean, you know, and do things for him. The president of AT&T would meet with this guy, and he agreed to send out correspondence for Ira, anything he wanted, to anybody.
And you have to understand this in the context of the 70s. The CEO said, hey, we've got to make ourselves aware of what's going on in this world. And Ira was the perfect conduit. Really, it was a very easy deal. We'll pay you your books, your mail, your telephone, your Xeroxing. Be our contact to that new avant-garde that was happening at the time, intellectually, culturally, and socially. And that's what he did.
So he had donors.
Yeah. The avant-garde, what a preposterous characterization of...
There are, yeah, of the dirty hippies.
Jewish hippie movement, yeah.
But it just goes to show, I mean, you got to think about this in terms of the 70s, in terms of like the communication capabilities you had in the 70s. The fact that the head of AT&T was promising to send messages. I mean, this is back when long distance was like $5 a minute, right, to just talk on a phone. And there was no internet. There was no – I mean, mass communication existed, but it was a tool of the rich and famous. And so for this guy to suddenly have access to mass communications where he could send – you know, whether it was maybe to coordinate a big rally or a protest or something like that, or to send out a newsletter, like a radical newsletter with that his Jewish friend was publishing that he wrote for, or, you know, maybe even you could say foreign intelligence agencies. I mean, the fact that he suddenly had access to all this stuff and they were paying his bills.
Yeah,
they were paying for his rent. They were paying for his food. And just giving him cash, to go in there and explain to them how to advertise to boomers, how to convince boomers to want to buy stuff, how to quell riots, how to, you know, quite literally it's controlled opposition.
Yes. And that's an important point we should hammer home. Controlled opposition, they typically don't raise somebody from the ground up. They allow somebody to emerge organically and then tempt them through practical means into using their power and influence, but redirecting it. So, I mean, this Fed angle, everybody's like, oh, people get captured from the beginning. They usually don't.
Right. No, and it would make more sense because, like, let's say you're like the Feds or whoever, you're some powerful entity that wants to influence people to believe certain things. I mean, I guess you could try to groom someone and then just kind of roll the dice and hope that they resonate with the people. And if they don't, you know, artificially pump them up in the algorithm or whatever. But we've seen that. It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Yeah. It has to be somebody likable, relatable, and it looks better. It looks more organic. People are less likely to recognize it as controlled opposition if they come up on their own.
Well, and it is more organic, right?
Yeah.
And so you have these people that do rise to the top because they are more charismatic. You know, they have these narcissistic personality traits that draw weak people to them. And they just leverage that. And look, because they are narcissists, like almost all these people have, you know, some degree of narcissism, usually like a criminal degree of it. They're easy to manipulate. All you have to do for a narcissist is give them more access to more money, more power, more status, and you know, tell them that they're geniuses, and you got them. You know, that's all there is to it. They don't have principles. That's the thing. That's the other reason why it's easy. It doesn't make sense to try to groom someone from the start and then send them out there and hope for the best when you can just find someone who lives off of clout and then promise them clout, knowing that if that's all they care about, they'll say anything as long as it's not unpopular, you know, as long as
it's so much less expensive as well. Because what if you raise somebody? We've seen people be, AstroTurf from the get-go. You have to pay so much in bots and fake support, and you don't really know who's going to resonate. Sometimes it's unexpected. So, you know, this was good resource allocation.
Right. So
look
that's
at the frame of this crazy Jew.
Well, and this fucking Jew here, I swear to God, like every soundbite from this is one of his friends who was also a professor at the time, mm-hmm. and couldn't. Not only that, we'll get into this in a minute. He ends up being a character witness, but this guy to this day, or at least as of this interview here, which I don't want to spoil anything, but let's just say he thinks the world of Ira Einhart or Einhorn. In fact, he talks about how Ira Einhorn had, again, this is before the internet. This is before there was online meeting houses. Everything was happening IRL. And so his online, meetings, his chat room, I guess you could say, was a real place called La Terrasse Bistro. And he would hold court in La Terrasse Bistro. He had a table that was his table, and he would come in, and people would literally come in to this bistro and gather around him to hear his monologues and his wisdom and his streams, I guess you could say, prior to there being an internet. And so this was something that, it just shows you like how technology has kind of shifted the landscape a little bit, but at the same time, yeah, things didn't really change that much. So this is a clip talking about, how that process would work.
What he used to do was basically sit in the center table and have all the people surround him, and then everybody would come over to him and pay homage.
You know.
Do you have any background on that clip? Like, what was he even doing?
It was in an America's Most Wanted clip.
I saw it, but they just like popped it in there. Yeah, they popped it. Totally normal.
Yeah, and I was like, all right, well, if that's the only clip I have of him talking, you know, I guess it's appropriate to use it because there's really not. There's not a lot of clips of him talking, so, or at least in this during this era, because they've kind of wiped it out.
But there I can are just, later, though.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And just, well, and think of it this way, as you said earlier, like if everyone's fucking high on acid and shit, like that probably, you're probably like, yeah, man, that's so unconventional. I never would have expected a man that's running such an event like this to go up on the microphone and just prove to the world how unserious existence is by just making silly noises. It's like a mockery of the establishment, man.
He's an absurdist, man.
Right. Yeah, so I could see how people would really, honestly, they would convince themselves that that actually was like some kind of brilliant performance art of some kind, you know? So, and in fact, one of those people who, by the way, did you notice this too? A lot of her pictures, she has her eyes closed. Like, yeah. More than half of the pictures of this woman, her eyes are closed.
Right, and then everybody was characterizing her as this stunning beauty, and I'm like, eh.
Yeah, exactly. She was like, eh. She wasn't fat, but yeah, I guess there's that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, this is Holly. Not, what is it? Not Murdoch.
Radix?
No, it starts with an M. It's MU Muddix is what it is. Muddix. I think it is. Let me double check. I've been looking her up all day, and now I don't know what her fucking name is. Ira Einhorn. And Holly, I think it's Muddix. Let me see here.
Maddox.
No, but it's with you. Or no, it is Maddox. It's you at the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So yeah, Holly Maddox. She was a conservative girl from Texas.
Yeah, she grew up in Texas, and her family was normal, conservative, and she still got totally indoctrinated into feminist ideology. They send her to college, big mistake. And then she ends up dating this fat, gross Jew and gets ensnared in his trap, which is her own fault. She's a very unsympathetic victim.
Yeah, because you do get that vibe that she has like that typical, you know, I went to college and found myself and threw away everything that my parents taught me because, you know, what do they know? You know, it's the age of Aquarius, kind of stupid, like, you
exactly.
Know,
that
kind of mindset.
They fail to protect her, but she wasn't, when they started dating, she was like, she was 25 or something, like, she wasn't 15, you know?
Right.
It's like, by then you should have kind of figured some things out, girl.
Well, she'd lived in the world on her own to some extent by that time. And, you know, like her dad, though, her dad was a World War II vet, you know, like most boomer parents or parents of boomers, you know, World War II vet. And they lived basically in a rural area, had like a, you know, totally normal family life, or at least at the time. And, yeah, she goes in and you know, he saw the shiksa. And he was like, I got to get me some of that, because Lord knows, no matter how Jewy you are, you know, Jewish women never become attractive.
He saw her. And here was this fat, bearded, belly Jewish kid from Philadelphia. And here was this beautiful, blonde, ethereal person walked in, and Ira was just in love. And what Ira did was when he wanted something, he just went over and did it.
Yeah. Imagine the smell. Like the smell alone, like his Jewish cologne that he wore everywhere he went. It just seems,
you know, her parents failed to put the proper Jew hating guardrails in because her father was a World War II vet, though. That's where they failed.
Right. Right. No. And I think that honestly, that should teach parents out there everywhere that that is the value in teaching your kids about racial differences, is they will be able to recognize these behaviors before, well, maybe something bad happens to them. So this happened. They met like around in October of 1972, and she even took her back to meet the family. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was, again, this was a missed opportunity. You know, the family, I think a lot of people are loathe. You know, a lot of parents are loathe to, like, they think, oh, it'll damage my relationship with my child if I tell them that their love interest is bad news or whatever, or you know, almost worse yet, oh, it's his decision to make that he's with a psycho girl or she's with an asshole. And they're very hands off, especially boomer parents. and they're very hands off, and they don't want to do what their duty is to your child. Your duty to your child never ends, even when they are grown up. You have to say, like, look, you're with a weirdo Jew, and this isn't going to work for the family. But because he gave them there was tons of red flags. I mean, just other than his smell, but here it is.
He helped himself to seconds before we'd even all had a plate. Then when he was through with his second plate, he leaned his chair back on two legs, put his feet on the table. That's universally known as almost a hanging offense in Texas.
What disturbed the family most was his attitude towards Holly.
I had a pretty thorough glimpse of their relationship. From his point of view, it was a master and pet.
It wasn't the same Holly. She was very subdued and very subservient.
Mm. Yeah. And she also told one of her friends, according to the Unsolved Mysteries episode, that he was beating her already at this point. So she was very, she had gone from like this bubbly, she was a cheerleader. Like she was a popular girl at the high school. She was literally a Stacy, and, you know, had lots of, you know, self-esteem, and it was like the life of the party kind of a thing. She comes home, brings this dirty Jew home with her, and she's really submissive and acts like, as her brothers put it, it was like a master and a pet. And, she has she had bruises on her. That's why her friend found out that she was getting beaten. She had bruises on her neck and stuff from him beating the shit out of her.
A handprint. She had a handprint on her neck. You know, the parents' mistake, their other mistake, was that they allowed her to go out into the world. Because if she had major dependency on her parents, financial and otherwise, then they could just be like, if you keep dating this gross Jew, you're out of the family.
Right.
And they didn't have that right anymore because they let her go out into the world and have all this independence. This is why daughters need to be carefully protected and then transferred to a husband of the parents' choosing. Transfer the child so that you can maintain control the whole time.
Right. You should be vetting. You should be vetting the people that your kids are with. And parental approval used to be mandatory, and now it's not even considered relevant.
Yeah.
Which is a bit odd. But that's the way, and look, you know, look at the results, I guess. But, you know, of course, even though there's all these reports that he's violent with her, all the Jewish friends that look fondly back at Ira, they're like, I don't know. He was always so nice to her.
I never, ever saw Ira do anything that was violent.
Yeah, never. Except for there's an article I found. Where, and actually more than one, where witnesses say that he was often violent and abusive with her in front of the entire friend group. So, like, which included this Jew right here that's on the screen, by the way, that everyone had to have been aware of it because it was a frequent thing for him to beat the shit out of her in front of everybody.
He was her guru, and he was battering her physically and psychologically. It was very difficult for Holly, but she told about how Ira beat her in front of the entire group. She had a very low level of self-confidence, and he had her convinced that she couldn't make it without him, Ms. Jean Child said. She also said he was pushing her toward sexual relations with women in which he would be the observer. He would tell her that sexual relations with women would open her up to new experiences, she said. It was very embarrassing for her.
So, obviously, because he's a Jew, you know, he's making her, you know, do lesbo shit for his entertainment, you know. I mean, obviously, you know, what Jew wouldn't be doing that? And she wrote about it in her journal, you know, extensively that she was being beaten. I understand you went through some of her journal entries.
Yeah, she talks about how he would beat her and then, like, drag her to the bedroom and rape her. It was super violent. And this idea that nobody knew about it. I mean, her friends knew about it. His friends knew about it. I'm not sure if they knew about the rape, but they for sure knew that he was beating the shit out of her. Everybody knew.
So it wasn't like even an open secret. It was not a secret at all. So she eventually has enough of this. And she ends
after up. After 5 years, though.
Yeah.
After 5 years, she's like, okay, I've had enough of the beating and the rape. This is when she's 30. And
right.
What does she do?
Well,
what does she do?
She goes to Europe to go find herself, I guess. Cuts her hair like every woman does when they're going through something. and comes home to New York and gets with another Jew.
Yeah.
So she's now with this other Jew. And of course,
she moves to Fire Island with this other Jew extraordinaire, who's also super Jew faced.
And
she acts like this is going to be a new life, like a new life by recreating my old life.
Yeah, I'll just be someone else's shiksa. Maybe that'll help out. And this, of course, drives Ira mad with jealousy, and you know, because he always gets what he wants, and so he tells her, "Well, if you don't come and pick up your shit that you left in the apartment, I'm just going to throw it all away." And
who cares? Just lose the stuff. It's like five things in there. I got to have this picture of John Lennon. I need to go back to Philadelphia so that I can get my picture of John Lennon, like my two hippie dresses.
Those are some really cute shoes, though. Oh, my God.
I know, right? But to my abusive boyfriend. And then all of her friends were like, oh, I wasn't worried about it. I was like, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, and in fact, even the Jew that she was shacking up with in New York, this guy right here, was like, I wasn't that concerned about her going back to, like, the psycho Jew, the smelly guy.
But on September 9th of 1977, Einhorn called her, and he was going nuts. He said, in her words, he was off the wall. He threatened to throw all her clothing and all her belongings out into the street unless she came down to Philadelphia immediately to come see him. He could not handle the fact that she was going with this other man.
Yeah, flying off the handle, psychotically. Yeah. No big deal.
Sounds like I should definitely go to his apartment alone. This is a selection event, okay?
Yeah, yeah. But it is a nice suitcase, though. I mean, that's pretty vintage. I don't know.
That was his suitcase.
Oh, that was his? No, not this one, though. I think this was actually her suitcase. Because this is the one that had a tag on it.
We'll talk about another suitcase.
Yeah, you're thinking about his trunk. So, so she goes to get her stuff and then never returns. And none of the friends from that friend group think it's weird that she's just missing. The Jew that lived in New York that she lived with don't think it's weird that she never came back. The family, however, thinks it's weird that she suddenly forgets everybody's birthday. She's not calling. She's not sending any cards. It's been several months.
People, I'm watching all these clips and everybody's like, you have to understand it was the 70s. And so people would just disappear all the time. I'm like, are you serious? People would just disappear all the time and just like go off and do whatever they wanted for months, for years at a time. Like, come on. No one found this suspicious. People were just not concerned about other people's well-being.
Well, I feel like there's probably two factors at play. One, everyone's on lots of drugs in the 70s. And actually three factors. Two, they're all boomers who are highly self-centered, and so they're not really thinking outside themselves. And then three, there's no internet, so it's not like no one, you know, oh, she hasn't tweeted in a week, or, you know, like there's no communication like we're used to today.
She had a live-in boyfriend. She was living at his house. She just doesn't come back after visiting her abusive ex-boyfriend. He's like, eh.
Honestly, though, after look, you know, watching some of these hippies clips that I've watched over the years, where it just seems like they were like that. They were just like, "Oh, I'm just going to leave one day, and I'll just start fucking some guy I met at the bus stop or something like that." You know, like that's when boomers go, "Oh, it was the 70s." That's kind of that's what they mean. Is they were just all fucking. They were all fuck ups. So the family hires a retired FBI agent to kind of, you know, try to find him. His name is Robert Stevens, and he starts this investigation because the police aren't even looking. No one's looking for her at all. The police are just like, she's probably just some hippie, you know, doing some hippie shit. And her friends are just like, whatever, you know, she's gone. Who cares? And so this guy starts walking around asking questions.
I had a telephone call from Mr. Maddox, who asked me, told me who he was, and told me their concern over their daughter, and wanted to know if I could help them. One of the things that bothered me was he had told the family on two occasions that she had merely walked out of the house that morning while he was in the shower and had never come back, never heard from her again. And when the police detective in Philadelphia talked to him, he said that, yes, she had called him about 2 days later and said that she would call him weekly. This wouldn't make sense unless he has something he's hiding. We wanted to make Ira feel comfortable. Even though he knew we were making inquiries, we were making inquiries concerning who could she have possibly gone off with, rather than in what grave she might be in.
So, yeah, they try to keep him, because at this point, by the way, according to all of his Jewish friends, this is where his career really takes off. Suddenly, like, he's not just, you know, getting kind of money funneled to him behind the scenes to consult and whatever, but he's actually, you know, doing all these speaking events, and he's actually getting invited to the big parties with important people. Now that his girlfriend has vanished. So they keep looking around, talking to different neighbors and whatnot. And the people that live just below Ira, what did they have to say about something odd that had happened?
Yeah. Okay. So these drugged out hippies from below, that one night they hear a blood curdling scream. And then over the next days, weeks, and months, they see smelly brown goo oozing from the ceiling. Now, they don't put two and two together because they're drug-addled boomer hippie idiots, and they just keep trying to disinfect and bleach this stain. And they're like, oh, man, what's this smelly stuff coming out? It must be like he's growing mushrooms up there, or maybe he cooked something weird. They get the landlord in there, and the landlord is like, well, that's Ira's closet. And so he goes up to Ira's apartment, and Ira's like, no, I can't let you in. I have all of these important documents in here.
He said he had secret Russian documents.
Secret Russian documents. Yeah. And so the building manager was like, oh, well, he's just some Jewish hippie eccentric. No need to investigate further. And then the downstairs neighbor just keep like spraying bleach on the blood.
Yeah, they're just like, give me the Lysol. I'm going to spray Lysol on it, and we'll just – maybe it's haunted. Yeah, maybe this is some weird Jewish, you know, ectoplasm dripping down from the ceiling from the demons inside of his closet up there.
Well, so, everybody knows what it was. It was, you know, decaying bodily matter. You can imagine. One of them actually had worked at a morgue, one of the downstairs neighbors, and he's like, oh, it smelled like a morgue in our apartment.
And I would know, because I worked at a morgue, but I can't put it together.
Jesus Christ.
I don't know what it is. It smells exactly like death. You know, like it's the distinct smell of death, but I don't know, maybe it's rotting Cheetos or something.
Do you think that scream of death had anything to do with this death smell?
Well, and of course they obviously, because they remembered it because they told the investigators. So yeah. It's not like something they heard and then, oh, they just didn't think of it the next day and it was gone from their memory. It obviously stuck with them because, you know, these stoner burnouts were able to, you know, remember it when the investigators came. So, yeah, it's a little weird, but anyway, so this, at least at this point, this gives the cops the ability to get a search warrant, because now she's been missing. They've got the testimony from the people downstairs, and his story has changed. So they get the search warrant. They show up at his house to serve him the search warrant, and he answers the door in a robe with ball, dick and balls hanging out. And they're like, hey, buddy. All right. Circumcised. Okay. We're gonna have to come in to your weirdo hippie apartment. Here's a photo of, I believe this is the front door. There's his study. I don't know. There's his nice kitchen. That's where he does his work, his best work. And, what's this? it's like a door with a padlock on it or something like that. That's interesting. So the investigator asks him, oh, you got the key to this? And I was like, no. Well, actually, he's like, and, you know, so they're like, all right, dude, we're going to have to break the lock here.
I asked Einhorn, did he have a key for that? And he said, no, he didn't have a key. I then told him that I was going to have to break it. We had a warrant. And he said, do what you got to do. I was able to take the hasp off of the locking portion without disturbing the locking mechanism itself. The first thing I saw was a closet full of boxes and a suitcase had a tag on it, and it was Holly Maddox's name on the green suitcase. I'm now in the closet, and the only thing that is left in the closet after all the boxes and the suitcase has been removed is the steamer trunk. And now the odor that I had smelled initially is even more profound. And I went to open the trunk, and there was a lock on the trunk. So I turned to Einhorn once again, and I said, do you have a key for this lock? And he said, no, he didn't have a key. I then got a crowbar, and I was able to remove the mechanism. And when I opened the trunk, I noticed laying right on the top were newspapers. And then I noticed that the trunk was all layered with styrofoam. This is the styrofoam that was in there. I then proceeded to start moving everything to the left. And the first thing I noticed was a hand. And the hand was mummified. The hand was looked as though somebody or Holly had tried to push the trunk open.
Ah, isn't that great?
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
So there is some evidence I heard from other detectives that there's evidence that she was put in there alive, and there were some claw marks also on the top of the trunk.
Right. Right. Now, he basically beat her within an inch of her life, stuffed her in the trunk, and then when she came to, she tried to get out, but was stuck in the Jew closet, covered in shit, and essentially just, you know, died there inside.
Yeah,
a
and they
coffin.
Don't know how long it took her to die. I mean, she could have been in there dying, trying to get out for days.
Yeah. So, the ultimate, the ultimate Jew move, I guess. He got his shiksa, and you know, she was gonna leave him, but no. I'll show that bitch who's going to, you know, she, even in death, she won't leave me. You know, that kind
yes.
of
and
thing.
He, around this time he was writing in his journal, which they found later. This is like the most poorly covered up crime I've ever seen in my life, by the way. And in his journal, or this might've been when he went to Ireland, but it says in order to experience beauty, you must first destroy it and then you can possess it. And doesn't that typify the Jewish archetype? That's everything that they're about. This was all the shiksa love and everything like this. This is all about
defiling,
acquiring and defiling and then possessing and destroying beauty.
Absolutely. And, he wasn't bothered by it at all. Like not even a little bit. After they find this, I mean, they're literally in his apartment with a mummified body a couple feet away. And when they're like, well, it looks like we found Holly, his response was so fucking Jewy.
I then immediately stopped searching and said to Einhorn, it looks like we found Holly. Einhorn said, you found what you found.
You found what you found.
He's trying to put this into some, he's trying to make this philosophical.
Right. And act as if, like, you know, there wasn't just the dead body of his ex-girlfriend in his closet for 18 months, which is how long it had been at that point. So
yeah, her remains at that point, they were totally mummified and they weighed 30 pounds.
Right. So 18 months of a dead body just sitting in your closet and just rotting away. He did try to get rid of it at one point by getting these two other girls, because somehow he had some power over women, and telling them that it was a trunk full of secret Russian documents once again, and that he needed to throw it in a river before the CIA got to it, because the CIA was going to get his secret Russian documents. But no, this was her coffin right there. This what yeah, that's where she lay for 18 months. So once that was all, obviously, they found the body, they arrested him for murder. But it's weird because even in the reporting, more contemporary reporting, like reports from the 90s, they can't stop glazing him, even though it's obvious that he's some psychotic murderer. You know, it's like they have to say, well, he was a lunatic murderer, but also a genius. He was a visionary ahead of his time. You know, even here. So this is America's Most Wanted. You'll find out why in the 90s they were still looking for him, and here in a second, talking about his case.
In all the years we've been on the air, we've never come across a character quite like Ira Einhorn. At times, he seemed like a drugged-out hippie lunatic. Other times, he seemed like a visionary genius who would take the world by storm.
He's a visionary genius that would take the world by storm.
Yeah. Yeah. What he's not saying is the whole time he was just a typical Jew.
Yeah, he was just this drugged out hippie Jew, actually, the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, so they arrest him. This is, well, as you can see, 3/28/79. So 1979, after she's been missing for about a year and a half, they book him. But his friends don't seem to even, all the friends that were very nonchalant about her going missing are also very nonchalant about him being arrested for murder. Partially because they believe his psychotic stories that the CIA is setting him up. You know, he's calling everyone a Fed, you know, that sort of a thing to get out of responsibility for his own actions. And this is a clip here with this. I thought the Jew that you mentioned earlier that we had that we were stuck on the frame of for a minute. Listen to how he describes like how the group is reacting to their friend being arrested for murdering the white girl that had been in their orbit, that, you know, for years, that they all saw, although they never mention it now, they all saw the abuse. They all at minimum heard about it. And now he's, you know, they found the body in his apartment. You know, like, it's not like, oh, they arrested me for murder because she never turned up. It's like, no, she turned up in your closet, you know, like locked in your trunk. So, I mean,
Ira could never.
Yeah. And it's, but no, in fact, even the ones that think, well, maybe if you, like, well, check this out.
I remember I was sitting in my office and I got a phone call. It's Ira calling from jail. And I said, Ira, what do you know? He starts to talk about Einstein with me. He starts to talk about what we had talked about, a couple, you know, the movie we had seen, as if nothing had happened.
Actually, that's the wrong clip I was thinking of, but no, but like, he's very nonchalant about it and whatever. And then this is, I think, the right clip where they talk about how it's like, oh, well, you know, no big deal. Oh, wait, no, that comes later, actually. Sorry, I jumped ahead. So anyway, he's really casual about it. He blames the CIA. His Jewish friends believe that, you know, maybe it is the CIA.
I was one of the people initially who said, you know, let's wait and see, let him defend himself. At the bail hearing, I said he would not run away. I didn't think he would because he told me he was innocent.
But don't forget, this is the period of conspiracy and paranoia, and everybody felt that they're, you know, that the CIA or some was doing all these clandestine activities. So the first response was, can't be, that they're trying to set Ira up.
Ah, yes. They're all
bullshit,
trying to set
bullshit.
Him up.
They just didn't care because it was going to disrupt their social life, their access to power, and because she's goy.
Right. She was one of the goyim. Didn't really matter that much. And they will, like, that same guy will actually, like this guy right here, will reiterate that later in the clip that I thought I had next there. And then, of course, he gets Jewish legal representation. I mean, obviously, right?
He was represented by former district attorney and current four-term senator from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter, who lined up a lawyer, a priest, a reverend, and a vice president from Bell Telephone to testify on Einhorn's behalf.
So, yeah, Turbo Jew Arlen Specter, who was a Democrat that would flip to being Republican, he was just whatever, he didn't care. Whatever, you know, like, well, like, I guess like some influencers today, just flip parties to achieve whatever insane goal they think they could do. But no, he ran as a Republican, got elected as a Republican, and then just voted for Democrats the entire time. And a lot of conservatives always hated Arlen Specter. Eventually he did turn back to a Democrat, but also, and I know, Rebecca's got maybe different views on this, but I think it's a little fishy. He was on the Warren Commission, and he's the one that came up with the magic bullet theory.
Hmm.
Yeah. So this
I don't
Jew,
like to get into JFK stuff.
I know.
People get so mad at me. And my mom gets so pissed about the JFK. Like sometimes I'll wake up and she'll just be fighting with my brother. I'll have like 75 missed text messages. They're just fighting about JFK. And so I'm like, I'm going to start a family war if I talk about JFK. But my opinion on conspiracies, like Charlie Kirk numbers amongst these, is that motive is insufficient proof of it's insufficient evidence. Like motive factors into every crime, but at any given time, a lot of people have motive to kill somebody else. So like I need more evidence than motive.
Well, this is, here's a nugget of evidence. Arlen Specter, Jew extraordinaire, was on the Warren Commission and came up with the magic bullet theory. He was also good buddies with Chuck Schumer, who refuses to die, and also Joe Biden, who also refuses to die. Although I feel like that's probably going to happen sooner rather than later, if we're lucky. So we got that whole connection where his lawyer is literally Arlen Specter, and not only that, he gets local priests and clergy, Christian clergy, to go to his bail hearing. And again, this is for bail for murder is extremely rare, especially for a case like this, where there's so much evidence that, I mean, physical evidence that points to, I mean, come on, who else did it? Like, is the theory going to be really that the CIA broke into his house and put a mummified body in his closet and then sent the cops there?
Right. You know, the fact that he was up for bail is truly remarkable. I mean, they found her body in his house. Her stuff was in his house. He had motive, which I know, yeah, what I just said, but he did have major motive and he was clearly the last person to see her. So it's like in any other case, like this would never happen today.
Right. But Arlen Specter was politically connected and he got all these Christian clergy to back up the idea in case, you know, like people thought that it was a Jew that murdered a white woman, which actually was a factor back then. And he got, you know, rich AT&T executives to come in and vouch for him, the ones that were paying him to be controlled opposition. And
yeah, well, they had to protect their asset, right?
Right, and the judge decided to give him bail.
Everybody, including myself, would go up and testify to Ira being this gentle, sweet, loving, intelligent person. The judge was himself, so he said, I'd never heard such glowing reports about somebody. I mean, he literally said that.
Yeah, that, and this smiling Jew was also one of his character witnesses, and he was a professor at the time. So he was also another guy. Oh, no, there's no possible way this guy is a crazy murderer. And then here's a clip from Unsolved Mysteries, which, you know, in addition to America's Most Wanted, also did a story on him. And you'll see why. Well, I think it's becoming obvious that if he's on bail, what would happen if he got bail.
Einhorn soon came up with an explanation.
Are you guilty?
No.
All right, now don't have questions like
he
that.
He claimed the FBI and CIA had framed him by planting Holly's body in his closet.
This is a public hall, and we would like to walk to the courtroom, if we may, without questioning.
Einhorn's attorney, one-time Philadelphia DA, now U.S. Senator and presidential hopeful Arlen Specter, pulled off the impossible. Bail for Ira Einhorn.
I was offended back in 1979 when they allowed him out on bail, because in my entire career, somebody who's charged with murder never gets out on bail, never got out on bail. And when I sat in that courtroom and I watched the parade of prominent people march before the bar of the court and sing the praises of Ira Einhorn, who was a murderer, but nobody wanted to admit it.
And guess who paid for that bail?
Who?
Barbara Bronfman of the Bronfman family, the same Jewish family that funded NXIVM, you know, the Jewish organized crime family that got their fortune from bootlegging during Prohibition and, you know, heiress to the Seagram's liquor fortune that was, again, gained through Jewish mafia, Jewish mob ties. And around the you know, in America around the 20th century or around the turn of the century.
This story is, it got so much Jewier than I ever anticipated, right? Was possible.
No, it never ends. And so She pays the $40,000, which again, for her, that's like 10 cents, right?
Yeah.
So no big deal. It didn't even really matter that it was that low, but that was still low. I mean, they lowered it to 40 grand because of Arlen Specter, the Jew. It gets all these people to convince the judge that he's like this little stinky teddy bear. And he has all these powerful friends, so how bad could he be? So Barbara Bronfman pays off the bail, and he thinks he's going to get off. He's not nervous at all. Here's the smiling Jew again talking about him after he gets out on bail.
And that weekend happened. Jerry Rubin was up, Peter Coyote, myself, a bunch of friends,
and
Ira was there. He came in the door. Also, we were talking about him, and all of a sudden he appeared, literally, just from nowhere. And we confronted him at that time. We all asked him. We pounded him with, "How, you know, Mitt, what's going on? Be a man. Be somebody who's sort of, you know, this is it's a horrible thing. It's okay. Maybe you get off on manslaughter. Maybe, you know, you can do all, you know, you can claim some other thing."
Maybe it's okay. You can claim manslaughter, and we'll get you. So they're not horrified at all that he beat his girlfriend to death and kept her body in a trunk in the closet.
Yeah, they're like, "How could we help you get out of this?"
Right. Yeah, we can just we'll just say that you did it on accident. You were like you had a momentary, loss of control, and you just beat her to death in a fit of Jewish rage, and that happens sometimes. Not a big deal. And so that's the clip I was looking for, by the way. So it's kind of crazy that the response from the friend group, because I presume that these were friends of his, so they were friends of her as well. And so it's not even just like some random, like, homeless chick that he murdered and stuffed in a trunk and put in his closet. It was someone they knew. It was someone that everyone, no one had anything bad to say about her, not even like his friends. So, he's not even nervous at all. He laughs it all off, and he's super confident. And then one of his Jewish friends, the one that ran the radical newspaper that he wrote for, told him, "Well, you better watch out, because the world's, anti-Semitism will get you."
And I said to him, "Ira, you're a overweight Jew with long hair, with a beard, wearing sandals, with dirty toes, who just allegedly killed a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant cheerleader."
Oh, my God.
I know. Right. God, things are as they appear, Jew man.
Right. And so, but it's funny because at least, I mean, that wouldn't even be mentioned anymore, at least not out loud. They wouldn't talk about the fact that, well, he's Jewish and you killed a white woman. But it did matter back then. People did think about those sorts of things. And they should start thinking about them again. But apparently either that talk or something spooked him, because he obviously didn't show up for his trial. He left, first went to Canada, then he went to England, and then he went to Ireland. Mm-hmm. Now, the weird thing I thought about the Ireland thing is he just shows up at some professor's house. I'm imagining he goes to like the student ghetto, like whatever, the neighborhood that's around the university, and he's knocking on doors. Because the story that this professor, this Irish professor tells him is that, "I'm sorry, I knocked on the wrong door. I'm just looking for a place to stay because I'm new in town," or whatever. And somehow, just by talking to him for a few minutes.
Like, "Oh, you want to live with me?"
Yeah. Yeah, like, "Oh, we got this mother-in-law's quarters back behind the house. And you seem like a normal-looking guy, right?" You don't seem like a psycho murderer or anything like that. You don't have those psycho staring eyes of, just come live with us. So he lets him live with them. It's really fucking weird that you would just let a complete stranger like that live with you. I maybe it's high trust. I guess, you could say it's a symptom of the high trust society, the white man's brain. But this is how he describes it.
"Ira dominated a lot of people, and I suppose that's how he did it. In an intangible way, through eye contact. You can't describe these things, that particular kind of charisma. but I think I sense some of his power.
Okay.
Look at his power.
Imagine being such a pussy that you let a stranger live with you because he looked at you a lot.
He wouldn't break eye contact. It's hard to explain. He just had this Jew gaze that I couldn't look away from. And so I said, why not live behind me and my family in this house for free? And so everything's going well, I guess, at first. But then the professor tells him, oh, I'm going to be gone for a little bit because I'm going to America to visit some friends. And Ira, being like the master criminal that he is, you know, keeping bodies in his closet, that sort of a thing. And, you know, he once he found out that this professor was going back to America, he said, no, what he said was, well, don't, whatever you do, don't tell anyone that you met me because they might want to extradite me back to America. And the professor's like, okay, I definitely won't do that now, you know? So he, of course, when he gets back to America, looks him up and finds out that he's wanted for murder. So he comes back, and there's no extradition treaty at the time between Ireland and America. So he tells the cops, but the cops are like, well, he's wanted in America. He's not wanted here. We can't really do anything. So he then tells Ira, all right, you got to go. You know, because I can't have a, now that I know you're a murderer, I guess, now you can't be here. So he leaves and he, bumps into him again at Trinity College. Cause again, this guy's addicted to like hanging out around students and trying to be like this, you know, big brained weirdo, with the youth. And, he's going by a different name now. He's going by Ben Moore.
Yeah. Did you hear about this? Why he chose this name?
No. Why?
Because it's paint, you know, and he wanted people to know that he was in their house. He covered the walls. He also considered going by Sherman Williams.
Oh, well, that's that's a very low key name to go by. How's it going? I'm Sherman Williams.
Oh. Maybe I'm he Michael. Thought that was too direct.
Well, I don't know. He looks like a, looks like a smart fucking guy there.
Genius.
Yeah, yeah, total fucking genius. So he it's weird that not only is he you can't extradite him because of the treaties or whatever. He doesn't really leave the area other than to he leaves that exact part of Ireland. But then he starts gathering in Ireland a new group of groupies. And he runs into some kind of, well, for Ireland, locally, famous people in their younger years.
By the end of 1991, Einhorn moved on to one of Dublin's most exclusive neighborhoods.
His house was directly at the back of ours, and I'd met him at a party, and he was an interesting guy to talk to.
Jonathan Philbin Bowman is now a television game show host and a newspaper columnist.
Look at that hair, by the way.
I don't know. I kind of like it.
Is he a Jew?
He might know. Be. He looks like it.
He looks like an Irish Jew. Could be.
Show host and a newspaper columnist. But back in 1981, he was a teenager who found Einhorn to be eccentric and offbeat with a guru-like following.
We're talking about slightly fringy alternative people.
So he gets like this following because he's talking about all these fringe topics and getting high all day, and I guess that fucking nonsense has traveled over to Ireland. But the thing that weirded me out was the same America's Most Wanted video that had this in it also talked about this guy. Do you remember this guy who he's the dad of?
Oh yeah, this is Courtney Love's father.
Yeah, so he starts hanging out with Courtney Love's dad. The spiderweb of connections of this guy is just really weird.
It's just bizarre. She's Jewish, too.
Yeah, and so he starts hanging out. He brings Courtney Love to him to meet.
Well, I saw him actually slap a woman in front of me. I saw him...
Naturally, I brought my daughter to
young daughter, yeah.
Commandeer a car and take a car away from a woman. I've seen him... yell at women.
again, so naturally brought, hey, Courtney, you want to meet this guy that beats women and yells at women and takes their vehicles by force?
And but he's very charming.
But he says he was charming to women and men. He had frequent breakfast meetings with Einhorn at this local hangout. Harrison even brought his daughter out to dinner with them, a daughter who grew up to be musician, actress, and cover girl for this month's Bizarre magazine, Courtney Love.
So, I was just like, the fuck? The fuck's going
on
here?
That's so bizarre. To be clear, though, she is, it's the matrilineal side, so her father is not Jewish.
Oh, okay. Well, the other thing he mentioned in the same interview is, he's like, I should have clipped it, but he was like, well, yeah, it was also well known that, you know, he had orgies and sex parties. I didn't go to the sex parties, but everyone knew about them. So he's having these orgies and like stinky Jew orgy sex parties. He's living in like one of the most expensive neighborhoods. How's he affording this? Well, it's because Barbara Bronfman is still paying for him. So the rich Jewish lady, again, the same family that funded NXIVM and all this other crazy shit, was not only funding him but visiting him while he was in Ireland.
She in effect admitted that she'd been sending him money. She actually had gone over and met with him in Dublin.
Yeah, so she's not telling the police where. I mean, he's a murderer.
Oh,
and,
my God.
Yeah, and not only that, he's so ballsy. Where his house was, where his apartment was, it was a couple blocks away from the U.S. Embassy. And he was so confident, he went to parties at the U.S. Embassy under this name, Ben Moore. And was, again, how does he even get invited? I don't know. But he's become a socialite overnight in Ireland just by showing up and having no background and just being like this psycho Jew.
Well, he should have been confident. He had all this institutional backing, and he basically was allowed to skip bail. Like, why wouldn't you be wildly confident at that point?
Yeah, I guess if the Bronfman family was funding me, I'd be kind of confident, you know.
Yeah. Like, oh, they can't touch me. Yeah.
So, because they can't get him, they decide to do this unusual thing, which I didn't even know that you could do, in Pennsylvania, back where he was wanted for murder back in Pennsylvania. They decided to try him in absentia, which means they can have the court case without him actually being there. And if, you know, they set the court date, if he doesn't show up for court, then they still have the trial and they still, you know, go through with it. And of course, this really pissed off his Jewish lawyers. You know, like this is one of his new Jewish lawyers, Norris Gelman. Again, who's paying for this? You know, Jews are paying for it. You know,
yeah,
I don't. Probably
I assume
it's the
Bronfman's. Yeah.
Right. And so he's going down there and arguing the case and saying this is a travesty of justice. You know, you can't have a trial without the defendant here.
I was at my desk and I got a phone call, and I believe it was Joel Rosen who said to me, "We're going to try Ira in absentia." And I said, "You're going to do what?"
When somebody fails to appear for their trial, 2, 3, 4 years go by and then we catch them and then we bring them to trial, what happens is we lose those cases quite often because we can't find the witnesses, because the witnesses don't remember what happened. So for us, the ability to try defendants in absentia is very important.
In September 1993, Ira Einhorn went on trial for the murder of Holly Maddox.
I thought the whole thing was quite unfair, but the judge ordered an absentia trial over my objection.
Gelman did not focus on the CIA conspiracy defense. Instead, he challenged the validity of the forensic tests, but the evidence was overwhelmingly stacked against him. Evidence that the downstairs neighbor heard a woman scream around the time of the murder. Evidence that a brown, gooey substance leaked into the downstairs apartment that prosecutors identified as body fluids. Evidence that Einhorn tried to persuade two young women to help him get rid of a steamer trunk that he told them contained secret Russian documents.
Everybody in this is so retarded.
Yeah.
Every step of the way, retardation.
Yeah, it just really, this is why I hate the 70s, guys. I just fucking hate the 70s so much. But the what was the verdict, Rebecca?
He was guilty.
Yeah, guilty.
Fucking guilty. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, the evidence obviously was clear. They only deliberated, I think, for like 2 hours. So on September 29th, 1993, he was found guilty. And they now attempted to get him because now he wasn't just wanted in connection with a murder. He was a convicted murderer. And they thought that would help them get him with the local authorities there. He then started bouncing around Europe, scamming more rich women out of their money and getting them to pay for his lifestyle as he went from different countries. And Scotland Yard was having a hard time finding him. I thought one thing was funny. They mentioned that another famous connection was Peter Gabriel, the British rock star, met with him and he gave him money.
God, so you have to ruin everything for me, don't you? He wrote the most romantic song that exists.
What song is that?
Peter Gabriel, In Your Eyes. Oh,
do you think that's the most romantic song that ever exists?
Oh, it's so romantic. I mean, it's
I like
for me
the
now.
Song, but
ruined for me. Absolutely ruined.
I thought you were going to say Sledgehammer. That's a pretty romantic song.
That's so lame. I can't believe he did this.
He just wants to be
all
your
these
sledgehammer.
People get bamboozled by him. It was so transparent.
Yeah. So, Peter Gabriel funding some of his escape.
Now, we also found out that he went to see a famous British pop star.
Who's been identified as Peter Gabriel. The pop musician had come to know Einhorn through his ideas of the paranormal. Einhorn had his private number and arranged a meeting when he reportedly asked for money.
Ugh.
Yeah, so there you go. Sorry. But they eventually track him down to a woman named Annika, I think Bauman or something like that. Who was a Swedish woman who was also wealthy and was paying for his lifestyle because that was, the next woman. Looked very similar, in fact, to Holly Maddox. And, thin, blonde, and whatnot. And they find him in this French chateau in, like, one of the most expensive parts of France, living it up by the seashore with this woman. And they decide to go in and arrest him.
Tracked down and arrested in France last June after 16 years on the run, Ira Einhorn applied for prison release, telling the French judges prison had ruined his life. In Pennsylvania, he faces life imprisonment, but he was let out of this court with a reprieve, a happy man. He's been freed but still faces an extradition hearing in December. The one-time New Age guru, Swedish companion, called the extradition request a kidnap attempt. She went directly to the prison to be reunited with a 57-year-old fugitive from US justice. They have been married, but he used an alias borrowed from an Irish friend, casting legal doubt over the marriage. Einhorn's lawyers say they fear that if he's sent back to the US, he'll be sentenced to death, contrary to French law. But Einhorn appeared confident. He said he was just happy to be free and going home.
Okay, Pennsylvania didn't have the death penalty at this time of his conviction, so there was a 0% chance he was going to get the death penalty. They knew that in France.
Well, not only that, if you look at this footage, he's so happy to be back in the limelight.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was almost worth it for him. Every clip of him, he's laughing and smiling at the cameras and hamming it up. He's so happy to be on that side of the camera and back on TV, and even if it's under these circumstances. But yeah, you're right that there was no death penalty. But so what the lawyers then switched to is saying that, well, in France, if you are, I guess they do have a form of in absentia trial where you don't have to be there. But if they do eventually apprehend you and you request a trial after you're apprehended, then you must at that point be given a trial. And because that's not how the Pennsylvania law was, they were basically trying to deny having to extradite him back to the United States. Here's yet another Jew trying to, all the Jews come circling in to make their Jewish lawyer
arguments.
Look at
that one-inch forehead. Look at that.
Yeah. No, these fucking Jews, man. Like,
got no frontal lobe.
They got no souls, what they got. No.
And in France, unlike the United States, and unlike the law in Pennsylvania, if a person is tried in absentia, and they're later convicted, and subsequently apprehended, they are guaranteed a new trial on the mere asking.
Yeah. But look, they're all happy. So they think they got off. They start doing a media tour. And this is where that 2020 interview happened, by the way, that you were looking for, mm-hmm. with Barbara Walters. In that interview, I found descriptions of it. You know, like Rebecca said, we couldn't find anywhere. But apparently in the interview, he's laughing. He's basically mocking the woman he killed and their family. His wife is feeding him grapes, mm-hmm. you know, like by hand. And it was such bad PR that it really enraged a lot of people in America. In fact, one of the things I found is kind of random. I found these two DJs from Michigan that decided to prank call him on Earth Day and call him a murderer. So here's that.
There we go.
That's the unicorn song from the TV movie.
Yes, is Ira there? I'm calling to wish Ira happy Earth Day. Is this Mrs. Einhorn? It's Drew and Mike calling from WRAF Radio.
Okay.
And of course he.
When's he coming back to the States? Because I know he's there's a that murder deal, the woman in the trunk and stuff.
Whatnot.
Would you like to talk to Ira?
Yeah. Could
sure,
you put him on?
That'd be great. I mean, he started Earth Day basically.
Yeah. Hang on a second.
Trunk. I know. It's not her fault, although she's a murderer.
Exactly. She's read the papers.
Bonjour. Hello?
Hello, Ira.
Yes.
Yes, happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day? Who am I talking to?
It's Drew and Mike calling from WRAF Radio.
Where's WRAF?
In Michigan.
Hi.
And of course,
locate you.
Of course, you started Earth Day.
No, I didn't really start Earth Day. I was one of the people who helped create it. I think it's Senator Nelson really started Earth Day.
Yeah. When are you coming back? Because I know there's, you have some things to deal with over here, and you've been over there for a long time. And I know it's not long before you're going to be forced to. Is it?
No. I will not be coming back. That's a rumor that has absolutely no substance.
Oh, I know, but you're going to be forced to come back.
No, I'm not going to be forced to come back, and I don't really want to talk about it because I don't think you know very much about it.
Well, I know a lot about it.
Well, I don't think you know very much about it. Can we talk about Earth Day? I'm much more interested in that.
I think the other subject is certainly a worthy subject.
No, I'm not particularly interested in talking about the other subject because most people over there don't know very much about it. I would much rather talk about Earth Day because we all live on the planet. And we're all
those that are dead.
But some people have been taken off the planet unfairly, and they have to be spoken for, too.
Well, you can speak all you want about something that you know very little about. The only thing I'm interested in is speaking about Earth Day, and if you don't want to speak about Earth Day, I will say goodbye to you.
Well, it's too bad you won't speak more about what you know about the other subject, because you could answer all the questions, and then it could be put to rest.
I'll answer all the questions when I have an opportunity. I cannot have an opportunity as a result of what Philadelphia has done. And
why not
when you do a little bit more research into that, maybe we can talk.
Well, I know what bail is, and I know you're not supposed to leave the country when you're on bail and never return to face trial.
You're supposed to have trials in absentia, particularly for murder.
Well, what do you do when people murder people and they're bailed and they leave the country?
I didn't do it. That's why I left the country. That's your problem. Do you want to talk about Earth Day?
No, I think it's your problem.
No, I think it's your problem. Bye.
Clearly you did it.
Oh, my God. Out.
Oh, he's such a dick.
Well, you can. But isn't it funny, though, that no matter how testy the whole thing gets, he's still willing to talk about Earth Day all the way to the very end. He's still ready.
So,
He beat his wife after that. Like, why did you take this call?
Because he's a narcissist. He can't help himself.
Yeah.
He wants the fame. And unfortunately for him, Pennsylvania, I think in part because of that 2020 interview, actually rewrote the law.
It did.
And made it so that, okay, in that case, we'll make it so you are able to have another trial And they did this after the prosecutors went through the information to make sure that they actually had a case so that wouldn't just, you know, be letting them go. And then, of course, the same Jews came out, you know, like a fucking, you know, bees come out of a beehive. We're like, yeah, no, no, that's illegal.
Now, on first blush, it would seem that this has cured the problem.
Simon, a defense attorney with an expertise in extradition law, argues that this new provision is unconstitutional and therefore unenforceable.
The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania goes on to say the legislature cannot, by an act of assembly, overrule a judicial decision. It cannot grant a new trial. It cannot direct a new trial.
This law is a ruse, in my mind. It's a snare.
Yeah, yeah.
A ruse? Is that what he was...
Yeah, that's what he was trying to say. What his lawyers were arguing was, because the way the law was worded, he wasn't guaranteed a trial, but I mean, he was pretty much guaranteed a trial. And the prosecutor's office said, "We'll give you another trial," but because the way the law was written, it didn't mean you automatically got one. And right. So they kept going and complaining to the French government, saying, "Oh no, we can't let this happen." But the French had another extradition hearing. And here's the news report for that.
Einhorn, a prominent anti-war campaigner and activist in the 1960s, is expected to appeal the decision to a higher court. In an unusual move, the court didn't order Einhorn to be placed in custody. The 58-year-old has been sentenced in absentia by a Pennsylvania court for the killing of Helen Holly Maddox, a crime he denies. Einhorn was well known in Philadelphia, where he once ran for mayor. Police found Maddox's corpse stuffed in a trunk in a closet at his Philadelphia home. Her sister is adamant Einhorn must be sent back to the U.S. to face trial.
Ira Einhorn will get a new trial if he requests it. I will be there. And he can no longer use that as an excuse to avoid the consequences of beating my sister to death.
Although the extradition depends on promises of a retrial in the U.S., Einhorn's lawyer says the issue is whether American authorities can guarantee a fair trial.
Yeah. But you see this in other cases, extradition cases. You get Jews that swarm in and to defend murderers and such, and they'll make the case that all American trials are unfair. Yeah. And so you can't be extradited back to the United States because it's impossible to have a fair trial in the United States, especially if you're black or Jewish or, you know, whatever. And which is essentially, that's what they were doing. And so he kept appealing up, you know, as far as he could. I think he even went to the EU's human rights court, whatever the fuck that is. And he lost, and they were going to extradite him. And then what did he do in reaction to that?
Is this a rhetorical question?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's for you. Yes. Remember, this is your favorite part.
Oh, good. Do we? Yes, because it's so shocking. This, and we can play it without it being censored,
oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I got
okay,
it.
Okay, so he slits his own throat. And when I saw this, I was like, dude, maybe this was a serious suicide attempt. But Devin, like, had me look at the picture closer. He actually just kind of like slit his fat Jewish gullet. Like he didn't get any of the stuff in there. And then he does an interview with his neck hanging open.
Yeah. So here's the footage. So to get attention, you know, he's like, I'm going to slit my own throat. But of course he just cuts open like the skin, his flabby, you know, gullet skin, but it's still nasty. Like it's nasty as fuck. Cause he just has like this open wound in his neck. So here it is. Okay. They'll zoom in on it. There. It's like
he
this.
He is responsible. He is the prime minister. He's responsible for all the people.
So he's got like that gaping wound in his neck. Like that's not just blood. That's actual wound because he slit open his jowls.
Not just the hope gone. Vous avez un scoop. Utilizing the scoop,
there it is. There's the close up. But he's laughing.
So
he's obviously fine. Well, maybe he's high as a kite too, knowing this guy.
Yeah.
But he's totally like putting on a show, and, you know, saying, oh, I'm innocent, I'm innocent.
This is performance art, don't you know?
Yeah, exactly. He's trying to be shocking. But as you can tell, here he is in the back of the ambulance, shit-eating grin.
Yep.
He's just like, ha, I'm on TV again.
Excellent. Double thumbs up. Ooh.
Yeah, exactly. So they do eventually, here's footage of him landing. I believe this is in July of, what was it, 97, I think it was. July of 2001. So they finally get him brought back to the United States. But even here, right, where he's getting led back to face trial, look at how happy he is that look at all the cameras. Oh my God, look at all the cameras. That's as happy as I've ever seen an old Jew. It's almost like he's in a solid gold police car, you know? Like, I can't imagine him being any happier than that. And it's kind of crazy that even after all of this, he's still enjoying himself. And, of course, he is found guilty once again with the new trial because the evidence is overwhelming that he murdered her. But even then, that same Jewish friend that was like, so what? Maybe we'll say it was manslaughter and we'll get you off. It'll be fine. You know, he still, even after the trial that it proves second trial, by the way, that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that all the forensic evidence adds up, that he is the last person to see him, everything. I mean, he obviously did it. The Jews are still trying to make excuses for what happened.
And the scenario was there were only three explanations. And they were all horrible.
No, there's one explanation, mm-hmm. actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
First explanation was that Ira did it. He was totally out there and said, I didn't do it. So he was like the greatest actor you could imagine. The second theory, we said, was a conspiracy theory. And that was even more horrendous. That would mean that the CIA, the FBI, the KGB was singling Ira out. The third element was that Ira did it, but that he actually used his mind to turn off the fact that he did this. That it was a moment of, you know, of losing control, and that he really wasn't Ira at that moment. It didn't happen.
Oh,
that's
no.
The classic psychotic.
He wasn't Ira.
There's no other solution. There's no other explanation. What is there?
This was a premeditated murder. He got her back from Fire Island so that he could murder her. This wasn't like a momentary lapse of judgment. He had a history of physical abuse. He was a sexual sadist. These people, they will go to the ends of the earth to defend him.
Right. And his goy wife, too, was also like in, you know, denial about the whole thing. And anyway, so he went to jail. I think he died in jail, what, around 2017 or something like that?
2020. Yeah.
So, he finally died in prison after, you know, being on the run for, what, like 15 to 18 years or something like
17
that?
17 years he made it.
There we go.
He made it, yep.
Yeah, and the whole time living large, living with a bunch of groupies, a bunch of people who thought he was some kind of, great mind that was going to change the world in some way, when in reality he was just some psychotic narcissist.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know what would have stopped all of this? An appropriate level of anti-Semitism, like a high level of baseline anti-Semitism in this country would have stopped this entire crime. Also, his entire saga in Europe, it would have stopped it there too.
Right. No, and that's the thing is with just a little skepticism of the out-group. Yeah, you protect. Well, first of all, she wouldn't. You know, if she'd been raised right, she would never have been put in that position in the first place.
Yeah.
And
although this was her fault, you know, I like to say, did she deserve it? No, but she had it coming. She had it coming. Like, what are you doing? And this is not just the out-group. This is Jewish people specifically, because Marx had a lot of physical characteristics in common with Ira. He also was physically grotesque. Was very, very smelly for the same reasons that Ira was. And he was covered in boils, and he was like really open about his boils. They were all over his junk and everything like that. It's like something about physically personifying the evil and how disgusting Judaism really is that like that gets them off sexually. It's like a sexual thing for them. Like, you're going to take this shiksa You know, it's some kind of weird humiliation ritual.
Right. So that is the story of the Unicorn Killer. They actually did a bunch of, they did a movie, they did a TV movie. I didn't watch, you said you watched it. I didn't really watch it. I do have, this is the promo for it if people want to see it. It's on, the whole thing's on YouTube.
An NBC motion picture event. He inspired millions as the creator of Earth Day. Found the girl of his dreams and killed her.
Oh my God.
Based on a true story.
Do we have any idea where he is?
Didn't anybody think to take his passport?
A father's global manhunt.
Help me find out what happened to my little girl.
For the notorious Unicorn Killer. That captured the attention of the world. Hunt for the Unicorn Killer. NBC Sunday in 3 weeks.
It's terrible. Don't watch it.
Well, yeah, it's funny. They made it sounds like they made like the father a main character. The father actually committed suicide before he saw the killer of his daughter brought to justice. And then her mother, you know, his wife, died of emphysema 2 years later. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
The parents never got to see justice. Her three sisters were the ones that kept it alive, I guess, to some extent. Did you notice how all three of them had red hair? How unusual is that?
I don't know. If they're Irish, then not that unusual.
All three of them, though. I thought that was weird. Anyway, so that is the story of the zebra killer. So let's take a look, I guess, at the little stupid intro thing's going to play again if I switch back to the normal, but we're going to do it anyway. I'll turn it off.
We should talk about our sponsor real quick.
Oh, whoops. Never mind. Hang on.
Watching.
There we go. Yes. Yes. What about our sponsor?
We have a sponsor for the show. Antelope Hill Publishing. They're the premier American publishing house for informed and principled political dissidents. They publish essential authors like Kevin McDonald, David Irving, Carrie Bolton, Dr. Ricardo Duchesne, Josh Neal, and more. Their catalog includes original works on modern issues like the opioid crisis and the people and networks pushing transgenderism, as well as original historical sources from National Socialist Germany, Fascist Italy, Spain, Britain, Japan, and Hungary, many available in English for the first time, exclusively through Antelope Hill. Their catalog also includes thrilling fiction novels and beautifully illustrated and wholesome kids' books. Whatever your interest is, you are sure to find something you want at Antelope Hill Publishing. Check them out to support our friends and our sponsor. Please use the code OUTLAWS for 10% off your first order. Please order something from Antelope Hill. They've been a great company. They're sponsoring the show, even though we say some stuff.
We do say some shit.
On YouTube. Sometimes I wonder if I'm the Fed. Never banned. Never banned. Thank you, Antelope Hill. We really appreciate your support.
All right. Well, let's take a look at Rumble Chats here. So we got the Shadow Band says, I think I sent you about this much via Entropy. Hopefully you can recover your account. Yeah, Entropy has gone under. And they're not responding to people's emails. Some of the very small creators have received their money, but they still owe a lot of people a lot of money, and they're not answering emails.
Yeah, sure would be nice.
Yeah, I sent them an email last week, giving them the deadline of Monday before I start exploring other options. They did not even reply to tell me they got the email, and Monday has come and gone. So I am currently exploring other options to... get our money, because that's not just my money for the Insomnia stream. That's, as you say, that's the money for Outlaws that was sent there.
I'd be so pissed if I sent money to Entropy and then I knew it did not get to its intended destination. I'd be so fucking furious. And I don't want to give too much information and I don't want to out anybody, but there are some content creators that are in deep on this one, like life-destroying amounts of money.
Right. All right. And it's a crime. Let's just think about it. Everybody on the right used Entropy because there wasn't really any other options, especially until Rumble came around.
Yeah.
And it's bottom line is it's just the lack of professionalism, just telling people what's going on. Like, it's one thing if you don't have the money to pay people for whatever reason right that second, as long as there's a plan in place and you let people know about the plan in place, but they're not even answering people's emails. So it starts to look like rug pull. It starts to look like Ponzi scheme. And I'm not saying that's what it is. I have no evidence of that yet, but that's what it looks like. Yeah, it's what it looks like when you don't tell anyone anything. They have to use their imagination to fill in the blanks.
Right.
So, but I appreciate that, Shadow Band. And, you know, we'll see. Like I said, I've heard some very smaller, you know, I'm not making fun of them, but like people they don't owe nearly as much money to, let me put it that way, got some of their money this week, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense why you wouldn't pay everyone at the same time, or, you know, at least the people you owe the most money to first, instead of people you only owe $100 to, because that's what makes it look weird. But anyway.
Yeah, and you waited a long time to say something about it. You've been waiting for money for months.
I was pretty patient about it. I know other people have bailed on them before and said some things publicly about it, and I made a lot of noise last stream about it because I was hoping that Monday would roll around. You know, some of that might get back to them, and they'd feel embarrassed and want to do the right thing. But apparently, that's not the case. But
yeah, you know. I see in the live chat somebody said entropy can't help it. The global financial gremlins stop him from accessing the financial system. Be patient. Yeah, but they're not communicating with anybody.
They're not even telling. Like, how do you know that? You know, did they email you? Because they didn't email me.
They didn't email us. Yeah.
They didn't email anybody. Like everyone I've talked to has said that there's been no communication. They've sent several emails and they're not getting responses. And that doesn't look good. Because like I said, if all they did was email me and say exactly that, like, look, you know, there's some problems because, you know, the global financial system or whatever, then okay, I understand that, but what's the plan? You know, what's the ETA?
And money doesn't just disappear. It gets locked up. But the way they're behaving leads me to believe that the money no longer exists.
Right.
And that's really what concerns me. I mean, I think that they probably have spent it.
Well,
and they're scrambling now.
Maybe, you know, maybe that's a possibility. And I hope that's not what happened, but that's, again, you have to use your imagination when people aren't telling you what's going on. And, it'll be a big blow to a lot of people if that's what happened. And then you'll have to wonder, you know, was there more to this? You know, maybe this was intentional, but who knows? Hopefully they're just really unprofessional and don't care that people are, their livelihoods are they're basically causing this kind of anxiety unnecessarily to a bunch of people because they're too busy. I don't know what they're doing. But
well, they're going to wash out major figures on the right.
Right. Right, absolutely. And that's a big deal. So we got Dagtastic says, hail Devin and Rebecca. Appreciate that. Arisen Ryan says, Becca looking like it, look at it girl from the Bell Bottoms era. Could see her hawking vowels on Wheel of Fortune.
Thank you so much.
There we go. Then we got USS Liberty says, not sure what the price of your books are going to be on Antelope Hill. Hopefully this covers my pirating the first one, like a dirty Jew. Still plan on buying both. Well, I appreciate that. And it won't be super expensive. I like to make things. I'm not one of these guys where I'm like, here's a book that's like 10 pages long. It's $80. It's like, no, I like to make it price what a normal book would be. Then we got Wolf Supremacist says, in the words of my wise Jewish neighbor, boop, boop, beady, boop, boop, oy vey, thank you guys. I love you both. Well, I appreciate that, Wolf Supremacist. Then we got Astralis says, I found a gay link on a beehive started in the Obama regime for Devin to look at. You mean it's like it's the White House bee? I'll take a look at that afterwards. But thank you very much, Astralis 725 Northern Michigan. Then we got Evergreen Dream says, Rebecca, you're probably tired of guys asking about the backlash, but did you ever get to keep that Nazi silver piece or did you lose it in the divorce?
Man, maybe I should talk about this. How much should I say? So I don't want to piss off Dave. You know, he's so spiteful. But he did go online and say that I stole $4,000 from him, which is not true. We all had access to the bank account, and that was like a month of back income for a few of us. And he was trying to get me to sign this incredibly ridiculous NDA with where I would have to pay if he ever heard that I had said something negative about him in private conversation. And so I just wanted him to change it to defamation. I'm like, just change this to defamation, then I'll sign it. And I'll give up all the rights to the backlash and everything like that. And he just would not do it. Like every separation agreement he sent to me was like increasingly ridiculous with indemnity clauses and all this other shit. And I was like, I can't sign this. And so he made me go through this contract negotiation for like weeks and weeks and weeks. And then eventually I was like, I'm just going to get the income that I've earned out of the bank account. I didn't take a cent more, just what I had already earned and was specified in our agreement. And then I'll just let him keep whatever else. I'll let him keep the content. And that's when he started DCMAing my YouTube channel. So did I get anything in the doors? No, I was like, I just want the income that I earned, which was like $2,000. And then he went online and said that I hacked into his bank account and robbed him.
There you go.
Yeah, crazy, right? Nope. But I lost that silver piece in the divorce. Short answer.
I hear he's a big fan of homosexual Mexican snitches.
I wonder what he's doing about this now. Jeez.
Oh, I think he's still a big fan. It's from what I understand. There's people that will never go against who they think is the most popular. They will, and that's what motivates what they do. It's clout chasing.
Yeah.
And I will never do that. I've never done that. And it's unfortunate that so many people. I guess one of the good things about what's happening with Nick is you're given the opportunity, whether you take it or not, it's up to you. You're given the opportunity to see who is in it over principle, who actually cares about white people and who cares internet points and being famous and all that shit.
Dude, if we're not going to have principles, then what have we destroyed our reputations for?
Right.
No. Like after you do this job, you can't. You have to live on the fringes of society. Like you can't function in a normal society anymore. And what did we sacrifice that for? I didn't do it for some, you know, Mexican homo. I did it for white people.
Right.
For white people, and we have to be principled. Otherwise, this was all, it was all in vain.
Well, and like I said, it's no different. It's funny because there's so many people that'll sit there and bitch about, oh, the boomers, they were lazy, so they hired Mexicans to do all this work for them. All right, look at this Mexican over here that I'm in love with that's going to do the job of the white man. And it's like, come on, guys, like you are the boomers. You're literally being the boomers instead of watching TV or watching a stream. But I mean, that's the extent of it. And
Go ahead.
No, just the idea that, you know, that the leader of whites should be someone who's not white is insane. It's insane. And I think that's just how browned out the younger generation is, you know, compared to the average Zoomer. Maybe he is white, you know what I mean? Which kind of sucks. That's kind of a symptom of the problem. But a symptom of the problem isn't going to solve the problem, you know?
Yeah.
So. All right, then we got Tomahawk says, Devin, I had to catch the replay of your Friday stream. Your explanation of how white nationalists discovered the JQ was spot on, for me at least. Yeah, and that's true. That's the other thing, too, is everyone's acting like a gay Mexican snitch came up with the JQ. You know, like that no one knew about the JQ until he came around. And it's like if you were red-pilled by a gay Mexican snitch, you are the new fag. You are the low human capital.
Lily Gaddis tweeted about this, and then I retweeted it because I wanted to get some kind of polling from my audience. And I said, like, who red-pilled you? And then I put a picture of Barbara Spector because that was the beginning of my journey in, like, 2016. Millennial Woe sent me that Barbara Spector clip and another clip about two Jews living in Europe, and one of them said, like, the last thing that I'll do before I leave Europe is spit. And this was – I've always been, like, skeptical of Jews because of my personal experiences and living in New York and everything. But this was when I was like, what? And that's how it happened. And then I had all of my audience, you know, tell me what it was for them. And not one of them said it was Nick Fuentes. He didn't invent the JQ. Like, I'm glad that he brought it to the forefront and that people are talking about it now, but he's backtracking so spectacularly that, you know, we have to think about the gains here. And that is what Leonardo Joni made such a fantastic video about this week. Did you watch it?
I saw like a clip of it.
Oh, it was so good. I encourage everybody to go to her channel and check it out. But we have to think like it's not really an argument to be like, well, he's done some good things, because to be credible in this sphere, you have to do some good things. I mean, that's the nature of controlled opposition. You can't throw somebody into the ring that has totally dissimilar ideas and everything like that. They have to say 80% of what you want. And we did this with Trump. We learned our lesson with Trump. He was saying the stuff that we were desperate to hear said. And so we overlooked these massive flaws, just massive flaws. And in the end, we were burned spectacularly. So are we going to do that again? Are we? We need to be discerning. And she says that she prays for God to give her discernment. And I think that's really what makes some people in the dissident right a cut above. Are they discerning individuals? And so I don't want to do this thing like I'm going to be the first to say that, like, after the Charlie Kirk thing, I fell for the Nick thing. I haven't always been a Nick skeptic. But this fissure with Dave and everything, it just made me realize that, like, I cannot fall into another cult of personality, because what happens if he dies? What happens, you know, any number of things. I don't want to have a single chosen leader.
I'd be real broken up if that happened. What a shame.
Yeah, but I got caught up in it too, because he's a master orator, and because he scratches that itch. Like, sometimes he says something and you're like, ah, that is what I needed to hear. Hearing somebody else say it in such a way, it's just so viscerally satisfying. And I did get caught up in that. And then I started seeing the quality of some of the groupers, and I was like, this is not what I thought it was. It's not what I thought it was. So I made a mistake. I was wrong. Elle Blonde.
Yeah, I mean, it's just he's obviously there to de-radicalize people. He's already doing it. In fact, I think I saw a clip today where he's telling people that we need to step back the criticism of Israel.
What?
Yeah, that's today. You haven't seen that?
Is it?
Well, I guess it's probably a clip from his show last night. But
I mean, I don't watch a show. I've been researching this all day, so I haven't been looking on Twitter. I mean, is this a product of this Dan Blazarian riff?
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing the whole again. It's walking it back, being more moderate, trying to be the new Charlie Kirk.
I don't like it.
Yeah, well, because it's bad no matter how you look at it.
Yeah, and for my audience, go back and watch Devin's stream from Friday. It was, he gets really mad, like really, really pissed.
I hate snitches. I just fucking hate snitches. And like that's the funny thing is people try to make this, they turn it into like this Finkelfink binary light switch brain bullshit where it's like, oh, you don't like Trump, then you must like Biden. You know, it's like, no.
It's like, no.
And yeah. you don't like Nick, then you must be on the side of Dan Bilzerian. And it's like, I don't know him. No, I just don't like Nick. I don't have to like someone else if I don't like Nick. You know, like that's not the way the world works. You know, like, there's not a set amount of people that I have to like. And if I get rid of one, I have to start liking some other person. You know, like that's stupid.
But binary thinking is a huge problem in our sphere.
It is. You know,
do you remember Dave's crash out on the backlash? I wonder if he took it down.
I saw a clip of him saying that, like, you know, basically that if you don't support Nick, that, like, you know, that's like the future of mankind. And it was like this, it was crazy over the top, you know, ball washing. And
yeah, he got so mad at me, and it was some like tepid criticism of Nick, and he just absolutely unraveled. I don't know if that show exists online anymore, but JF did cover it in that stream where he says all those really gross things about me. If you want to go watch that one. But I think that's kind of the groper mentality. It's like, if you criticize him at all, then it's a denouncement of his entire philosophy because he is America first. But he didn't invent America first. Pat Buchanan is, you know, you could argue that he is the originator of the America first philosophy. I mean, and he was talking about Jews in the 80s.
Right, and you could go even further back, you know, to, you know, the Lindenberg or Henry Fords of the world, you know, like, yeah. There were people, and in fact, they used those terms, America first, prior to World War II.
Yeah.
That was a slogan to keep America out of World War II.
Yeah.
The Bund in America said, you know, used the slogan America first. You know, and so you have, it's not like, you know, he not only did he just borrowed it, he recycled something that already existed, which is literally every one of his views. Nick hasn't come up with anything original. Everything, no. In fact, 90% of what he says now, he got mad at people saying just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
You know, he would be optics cucking and saying you can't talk about Jews because, you know, like that I guess that's optics, you know, bad optics. And then for like 2 years straight, that's all he talked about was fucking Jews.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. This pisses me off about the movement. We need to have more self-confidence in our abilities here. We don't need to pin the origination of these ideas on one person. We can think critically about things. We can come to conclusions on our own. And I think we need to set a higher standard for leadership. We've done this with Trump. Like we need a leader that really represents the maturity of the movement. And I think it is, I think it's maturing in a way that people want, that there's a desire for something like a little more adult in the movement now.
Well, and race matters too, you know, because for the same reason why you can't trust a Jew who might appear white and maybe even sometimes identify as white when it's convenient, Jews will always go back to their real identity as a Jew, and their priorities will always be to their race, which is Jewish. Nick Fuentes has 0% blood relation to the founding stock Americans. He has 0%. It's not just the fact that he's part Mexican, which is, that is a big deal. It's not just the fact that he is a racial chameleon in the same way that Jews are, where he, under pressure on video and often, says, "I'm not white, I'm Mexican," when in the same way that a Jew would say, "I'm not white, I'm Jewish." Like, mm-hmm. There's no discernible difference whatsoever. It's not even the fact that he often talks shit about Anglos and founding stock Americans and talks about how they're basically incapable of helping themselves, and he believes the Jews when he calls them dumb goyim, and that, you know, he thinks they're dumb goyim too. The fact that he hates poor white people but he loves rich black people, you know, race matters for all those reasons.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then I think that the crux of the issue here, outside of whether or not he's a Fed, is like, do we have to do this Big Ten conservative thing? And I shouldn't even call myself conservative. I'm really not. And I think it's just a losing proposition. We don't need numbers. We need quality. And the people that have quality are the people that are sticking to their principles rather than the cult of personality. And this is a culling event, and this will illuminate the vanguard that can now emerge. And I'm happy to see it happen. It was very predictable the way this played out.
Yeah. You can't have a narcissist like that at the top of an organization leading anything, or you end up like, you know, in Nick's case, you'd end up with Mexican gay Mex. Imagine if Trump was gay. Like his behavior is already like shitty because he's got like that ego and he's a narcissist. But if he had like the fag tendencies on top of all that,
yeah, it's like, just too much.
It would be it'd be absurd. Like the amount of backstabbing that Trump, I mean, it's already absurd the amount of backstabbing Trump is capable of. If he was a homosexual on top of that, it would just be like, oh, forget about it. We'd already be in World War III right now for the Jews.
Yeah. So before we move on, though, one more thing on this. Once you introduce an idea into the public sphere, it belongs to this public sphere, It's not your idea anymore. And all of us should be doing this so that we can change the consciousness, so that we can connect back to our ethnos. That's why we should be doing this. If we're attaching it to any individual, then we're already lost here. This is about the people. This is about the country to a lesser degree. And if you're not doing it for that reason, then you're doing it for the wrong reason. You can't be trusted.
Right. If you're doing it to gain power, as Nick clearly is, which is why he cozies up to people who are fundamentally opposed to us if they have more clout than he does, and why he throws anyone that he feels threatened by because of their popularity, not because there's any conflict of, unless he's not who he says he is, not that there's any conflict of interest. He's quick to throw anyone under the bus that is on the side of white people if they're not on bending the knee to him.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people are like, well, you guys are just jealous that you haven't gotten the scale that Nick has. And it's not jealousy. It's more, not that I would ever want to be that famous. I think that would be a nightmare. I think it would be life ruining to be that famous. But I do have a resentment that, like, we're still the kind of movement that is accepting these narcissistic personalities rather than people that are really putting forth ideas for the right reason. Like, it makes me hate the movement, and that's why I'm angry about it.
Right. And I in no way want to be the leader of a movement. I'm a podcaster. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, if I'm bitter about anything, I'm bitter that more people know who Nick is than they know who Jared Taylor is, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, not that Jared Taylor is good on the Jews, because he's not. But I mean, there's people like that are old school, that have been around a long time, that most of the world has no idea exists. But to be honest, most of the world doesn't know who Nick is either. His popularity is way exaggerated on platforms like Twitter. Not that he's a nobody. I mean, he's been covered by mainstream media, and I'm sure he'll continue to be covered by mainstream media because that's the movie he's making, is to be a mainstream pundit. And yeah. So he'll be around for years to come. In the same way, like, look, even though most of us don't ever think about him, Ben Shapiro is still out there. Even people like, even Bill O'Reilly, for fuck's sake, still does a show.
Seriously?
Yeah. And Glenn Beck, you know, all those guys are still, they're out there, you know, but no one, you know. So,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
They'll
we
be
talked
like,
about doing a show about how you can recognize if somebody is controlled opposition. And I think that that's still an important show that maybe we should do in the future. But one of the things is that you can't trust anybody that wants to be famous, because it takes a massive personality defect to want that kind of life. Like, imagine what Nick Fuentes' life is like on a day-to-day basis. He can't function in society normally without fear, without being recognized all the time. Like, I'm small enough that I can just live my life and no one really knows what's going on and everything is normal. But to desire to be like in the spotlight all the time when you're grocery shopping, you have to have something wrong with you. Why would anybody want that? It seems like a nightmare.
Well, and everyone, I think, on some level knows that. That's why, even though it's probably bullshit, it's probably just part of the mythos around George Washington, you know, like the whole story about, like, he didn't even want to be president. Like, the reason why that was such a good myth, which it probably is a myth, and the reason why it sticks with so many people is people have an instinct to trust someone like that, because they know that they're like the reluctant leader that's doing it, not because they want to be famous or because they want to be the president or whatever. They're doing it because, in fact, a lot of that same myth that's what they would say about Trump, right?
Yeah, is a myth.
Yeah, it's total bullshit. Trump loves being, you know, obviously, but the reason why they made up that myth was, on an instinctual level, people realize that's the kind of personality type that should be leading, is the people that aren't doing that of some selfish reason. So they're not, funny enough, they're not getting rewarded the same way as a narcissist would be rewarded, because a narcissist
will be
rewarded simply by getting, you know, the adoring fans
and the accolades and everything like that. This is why I like Arvall, though. Because he did not want to be president of Return to the Land. He didn't want to do this.
Right.
But he basically was the best person for the job. And so he was like, ugh, fine, I will do this. And I think that makes him trustworthy. That makes him appealing in a way that Nick is not.
Right. Absolutely. All right. Oh, speaking of which, I think I'm going to be streaming with Return to the Land tomorrow at 7 o'clock Central, I think.
Okay, cool.
So
where can you find that, Devin?
I don't know, actually. I just got invited, like, literally right before we went live. And I said I could do it, and then we went live. So I don't know if he accepted the acceptance. but I think it's 7 o'clock at Central Time on, I guess, whatever. I think they must be on Rumble, right? Return to Land has to be on Rumble.
After that whole speech I did about being famous, I'm going to chastise you for your lack of shameless self-promotion. I'm just a walking contradiction today.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know. I don't like to. I just don't think about it. I got a job that I like. I'm in it for the research. I'm in it for the education.
It's so fun. That is my favorite part of this job.
Oh yeah, when you find
it's
out
so
like.
Much fun.
Oh, here's this. Here's a scummy Jew. Oh, God, he's got. Oh, wow. He's got. The scumminess never stops with this guy.
It never stops. And, like, sometimes, I don't know, people probably understand our process, but, like, sometimes you get into a video or a script or something like that, and it just yields nothing of value. And then sometimes you get into one like this, where it's like every twist and turn has some kind of layer to it. And it's so, like, this was such a fun show to prepare for.
Right, yeah, there's some that sound really good on paper at first, and then it's a nothing burger. You're like, all right, yeah, some Jews did some Jewy thing, and they're like, that's the end of it. That's
they own really the circus, yeah.
Yeah, that's not all that interesting, you know? But then like, yeah, this guy, it's like, it starts off like, oh, some Jew killed a bitch, and then you're like, holy shit, it's not just, that's not where it stops at all.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
There we go. We got Churro Man says, revoke his white card, but Taco Bell is far more Mexican than Nick's DNA and character could ever be. Mexicans have enough on our plate. Fuck that faggot. He ain't ours. Godspeed, fellow racists. Well, I appreciate that, Churro Man. I'm assuming you're Mexican. I would say, yeah, well, look, that's the thing. Just like Tim Pool, he's racially confused. That's why Tim Pool obviously will never be a white nationalist, because he's half white, half Korean. And anyone that's mixed race has these kinds of identity problems. In fact, think about it. Who out of everybody was the most vocal against race mixing in the last decade? It's been Nick, who's a product of race mixing. And so, you know.
And IVF.
Yeah. So think about that for a second. Like, why would someone who is the product of race mixing and IVF, both things he's against, be so vocal against it, unless on some level it's because he hates himself, which a lot of narcissists do deep down. And so it's just, he's trying to prevent more people from being like him. Because you do have these confused racial identities, not just with him, but any mixed race kid. They're not white, they're not this, they're not that, they're not anything, you know, like, what, are you going to go to like some, HAPA nationalist, party, you know, like where you're one of like the tiny percentage of mixed, white Asian kids. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, to do that to your children or to yourself really. That's the problem is, you know, it's funny, people were saying he's only 17% Mexican, but in terms of genetic distance, the mestizo blood was isolated from European blood for so many tens of thousands of years that it's not just a matter of percentages, it's a matter of what it's a percentage of when it comes to genetic difference. Just like if you have a glass of water and I put a droplet or let's say I put a few grains of salt in the glass of water. You'll drink that, and it's not a big deal. If I put the same amount of botulism in that glass of water as I put salt, you're going to fucking die. Even though it's the same percentage water, right? But one is, like, way worse than the other. And the mestizo blood is so separate from the European blood because of the genetic isolation that took place with the natives. He is more genetically distant. I found, like, when I was looking at this, he's actually more genetically distant from Europeans than Ashkenazi Jews.
Really?
Yes. Yes, really. Mm. Because of that genetic factor. Not all Ashkenazi Jews, but like the Eastern, like the Netanyahus of the world. Right. So, you could say, well, he's not really Mexican. It's like, he's not anything. He's not really anything. You know, he's like Italian, Irish, Mexican, whatever the fuck, right? North African. Yeah. And so that's why he'll never be pro-white, because he's not white. And he's never going to be pro-America in the same way that a founding stock American's going to be, because he has no blood relation whatsoever to any of the founders, any of the original colonists, any of the people that fought in the Civil War. He is a latecomer. His genetics came here much later from foreign lands. He's a mix of different foreign peoples. And so psychologically, if nothing else, that matters, you know, like think of my ancestors, I think of like the pioneers, I think of the people fighting the Revolutionary War. Those were my people. And so I'm always going to have a fondness for that, or at least a relatability to that and a desire to preserve what that meant. And for almost no other reason, because that's like the whole thing with white nationalism is it's your family. It's not like an aesthetic thing. It's not even an IQ thing. If it was an IQ thing, we'd want to be flooding our countries with Asians or whatever, but we don't want to do that either.
Reason that we abandon libertarianism is we all understand now that it is an impossibility for humans as a whole to sublimate their tribal and genetic desires in favor of a personal philosophy. And I think that this is expressed really well in Nick, because at his end game, although he does have a lot of self-awareness and he has a very high IQ, his end game is always going to be to carve out that area for his people and his race, even if he doesn't realize, which I think he probably does, but even if he doesn't realize that that is what he's trying to do. And that's what all of us are trying to do. And that's what white nationalism is about, just recognizing that this is the people that we are, that this is going to be our biological desire, and kind of just accepting that there's nothing else that can be put in front of that.
Right. No, we're all driven by our biological needs to ensure the prosperity of our genetic lines. And Nick is just not part of my genetic line, and I'm not part of his. So that'll always be the case.
Can't respect a man with tummy troubles. I just can't do it.
Tummy troubles.
Oh, he always talks about how he like can't stomach certain foods. And I believe in the gut microbiome and it like being a very important marker of biological hardiness and health. And so like if a man can't eat old Taco Bell or whatever,
right,
he's like, I've got a stomachache. I'm like, whoa, you have no genetic fitness. You should be killed on the spot.
Well, mixed race, mud IVF baby, you know.
IVF actually destroys the gut microbiome of children, so they have a much higher rate of IBS and other diseases like that, autoimmune gastrointestinal diseases. Right. IVF is a huge problem. Don't get me started on that.
Yeah. Well, and you know, obviously the other genetic issues he's got, and the homosexuality, and you know, which look, his twin sister is also homosexual. So
is she really?
Yeah. You didn't know that?
No, I didn't. She's very beautiful, though.
That's my understanding. I don't quote me on 100%, but people have been saying that for years, that she was a wokey, maybe it's one of these things where she experimented in college, but my understanding was she was like a wokey leftist lesbian.
Yeah, but so, lesbianism isn't real.
Yeah, well, like, again, like I said, it could just be like a college thing, you know, whatever.
No, but, I think sexuality is more fluid in women. Like you to be a man and take a dick in the ass, like you really have to be committed.
Yeah.
And commit to the bit there. But like women, it's like, I don't know. That's fine.
Yeah. You have to really commit to the Nick there. All right. So we got Tomahawk says, Rebecca, how the hell do you find all these fucked up stories?
This was actually Devin's pick this time. I was going to talk about the Jewish circuses, but there just wasn't a lot there. It was like, yeah, circuses were owned by Jews. And that was pretty much it. But although, I do a combination
I feel like
of,
there's still something there yet.
We there just might be something. We it. Might talk about that in future. I don't know. It's like a combination of every time a listener suggests something, I put it in an outline. And then I've done some AI training where the AI thinks that I'm Jewish and I'm trying to steel man an argument, like an anti-Semitic argument. So I've really trained the AI, and then I ask them questions about like crimes that Jews have committed and things like multiracial crimes, crimes against white people, financial crimes, and then a, you know, keyword search.
Oh yeah. I can't tell how many times I've told AI I'm preparing for a debate against a white nationalist.
I did and, that too.
And I want to understand their thought process on this particular subject. Please steel man this position and give me citations and examples.
Yeah, exactly. I'm making the thumbnail today. And so one of my AIs wouldn't do the yarmulke and the stink line. And so I convince it to do the yarmulke by telling it that I was Jewish and all this other shit. Like, I'm a Jewish student and I just want to, you know, to steel man this argument, blah, da, 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 da. And then I had to put the stink lines on with Grok, which will do anything. Grok will do it.
Almost anything. It still fights with me sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it's way less much of a bitch when it comes to doing text or image generation.
Yeah.
All right, then we got Mayo Supreme 88 says, this is a prime example of where goys can't prosecute a Jew in Gentile court if the punishment will be considered too harsh by Jewish law.
Yeah. I can't remember what it's called. Didn't we talk about that a few weeks ago?
We did. I'll tell you one thing, though. That whole town, Philly, must be so Jewed up because the prosecutor was a Jew. And in fact, everyone that was a Jew, except for the Italian cop that found, like, the actual homicide detective that found the body, and then the Italian, cop that worked in the extradition office. And in fact, I cut this out of the story, but because it just, I mean, it was just a minor thing, but that Jew that ran the radical newspaper, one of the things that drove the Italian to stick with the extradition for so long is when he went to go meet with that guy to find out whereabouts of Ira was, he said, you'll never find him because he's smarter than you, and you'll never find him because you're not smart. And so the Italian guy's like, oh, yeah? and that was like the fuel that fueled his fire to make sure he got that fucking smart
Jew.
Yeah,
I saw that, yeah.
So let's see here. Then we got Mayo Supremo says Halakha. Yeah, that's the name of it. That was the you can't turn another Jew in. So that's why all of his Jew friends were not cooperating. That's why the Bronfman woman, likely, at least that might have been part of the motivation for her to pay for him. Because, yeah, he would be tried for killing a goy by a goy court. Although I'll tell you, those court drawings, did you see the sketches, how many black women were on the jury? The fuck, man,
like, sweating there for a second. Oh, we talked about this with the Jewish police force episode. That's what it was. Okay.
Yeah, fucking Philly, man. It seems like it's been Jewed up forever.
I want to go there still.
I've been there. It's not that great.
They have this awesome medical oddities museum, and so
you want to see like mutated people in a jar?
Well, they have like a 40-pound colon that I want to see.
Oh, good. It's
a medical oddities museum called the Mutter Museum. I've always wanted to go. It's a lifelong dream. So my husband told me, like, I will pay for you to take a weekend off from the kids, because I've never been away from my kids before. And I was thinking about, like, what do I want to do? And I was like, I want to go to this museum, but it's in Philadelphia.
And Philly cheesesteaks are not all they're cracked up to be.
Yeah,
I mean, they're all right, but the way they acted like they reinvented like the sandwich somehow, and it's like, no, it's just a sandwich with like meat in it.
Yeah, fine. Yeah, they have an elephantitis leg too. Also, this doesn't interest you.
Oh, elephantitis leg.
None of this does anything for you.
No, it's yeah. Maybe we should do one about the circus, so you can have fun with the freaks.
Oh yeah. I've seen that movie many times.
Yeah, the Freaks.
1932. Yeah.
One of us. All right. We got Professor Chaos says, I'll check out the replay later. Keep up the good work, guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Let's see. Then we got Love and Division told me to check Odyssey. Odyssey says, what happened to the lynch mobs that took care of Leon Frank? By the way, people... Antelope Hill, promo code outlaws without the quotation marks. There you go. That's another problem is it was up to a Jewish DA. And it was up to, all of these Jewish lawyers, the judge, I'm not sure if they were Jewish or not in the case, but the judge that gave him bail in the first place, obviously that was a problem. When they should have just lynched him. The second they found the body in his closet, that he was, and it smelled like death. And you know, there's no way. I don't care how stinky this fucking Jew was. There's no way he didn't smell a dead body in his closet for 18 months. And he had the keys not only to the lock, the padlock, but also the keys to the trunk. So, I mean, there was enough evidence to where, like, right off, like, immediately, within, like, 10 hours, he should have been hanging from a tree.
Oh, yeah. For real.
That's actual speedy trial right there. They should have tried him in the streets. They should have said, guys, there's a dead chick in his closet. And that's the trial. Everyone's like, oh, well, I guess he did it. Let's do it.
Yeah.
You know, that really should be it. I mean, I'd be like, I'm convinced, you know, kill him. But yeah, instead, how much money was spent? You know what I mean? Like, how much goy money?
Chasing him around on his shiksa banging journey of in Europe and everything.
And fuck all those European bitches that were like funding his lifestyle. Yeah. Then we got Mayo Supremo says, have you seen anything about the Chud, the builder live streamer guy? Apparently he shot some nig today while live. Pretty wild. Yeah, I did see that.
Dude,
yeah,
one day off Twitter.
Yeah. No, I didn't. Again, I was preparing for the show, just like Rebecca was. So I just saw that it was on Twitter, and I saw that he wasn't dead, and I was like, okay, so he shot someone. The tweet I saw said that in shooting the other guy, he accidentally shot himself in the arm, too, or something like that. So I guess there was maybe a scuffle or something, but he's not, you know, he's not in any physical danger.
His face is okay, right? That's the important thing. Okay.
Yeah, he still looks normal. I saw there's a picture of him on a gurney, and he was like alert and normal looking. So I think that
both sustained gunshot wounds.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens with that legally. We got Ambgun says ambidextral gunfighter here. Kindle book promo for Outlaws and Insomnia Stream fans, look at ambgun.com. All right, well, there you go. Does that mean you're ambidextral gunfighter? Or do you actually like those quick draw competitions?
Like cool.
I don't know if that's really what you do, but there are people that do that, and they're just as fast as with their left as they are with their right hand. That'd be cool. Anyway, Corsica SS says, hey, Devin, I bet you could do a really good remake, some reimagining of everyone's favorite German marching song, Erica. It's not all of our favorite topics. Oh, no, it's got all our favorite topics. Germans, girls, and bees. Keep up the good work, you two. Well, I appreciate that. And I don't know. Sometimes the AI I use will freak out on public domain lyrics. It'll think either it's copyrighted, or it'll just say it won't do it for no reason. Like, I tried doing this, like, I was trying to mimic the song from Brother, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where they find the KKK guys in the forest, and the head KKK guy starts singing Oh Death, where he's like, Oh Death, Oh, because it sounded really cool. And I was trying to get the AI to yodel like that, but also have like a fucking hardcore like techno beat in the background. And that's a traditional song. It's obviously in the public domain. And if I tried using those lyrics, it would tell me that it was copyrighted. And then I mixed them up a little bit, and then it just wouldn't do it and didn't tell me why.
Yep.
So yeah, we'll see. Then we got Natural Order Paul says, Rebecca, can you get a copy of my novel Secret Hitler from Henrik and Lotta next week? I hope you appreciate how it deals with issues of controlled opposition, infiltration, and non-binary thinking.
I will order it online so that you get some of the proceeds. How about that?
There you go. Then we got Truth Forger says, love your hair tonight, Devin. Book Track Grooves says, scripture for today is Judges chapter 2. Hope you guys are well. The quartering is crashing out.
Is he?
That's more drama that, like, I've just sort of, like, I've seen in the periphery where he was, like, erasing channels that I guess that he had with, like, Count Donkula. I don't know. People are just losing their minds the last, you know, couple weeks. Everyone's crashing out. I don't know what the deal is. Maybe it's, you know, it's just we're getting close to Armageddon. Then we got Art Stanton says, yes, Rebecca, I'm very pissed off that money I sent to Devin never got to him. And what if it was all a fed up? Now I'm imagining having all my anti-Semitic chats read out in court.
Dude, and the rest of us, though.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be like that. But I'm going to try to remain a little optimistic. It's with every passing hour, it looks like there might have to be legal action taken.
Yeah.
Then we got Reinhardt says Backlash episode 90 is Dave's hissy fit, ultimate Groiper crash out. Even if Nick were a great man, this level of worship would be emasculating. But all of this for Nick, zero self-respect is a red flag.
I was very proud of my conduct and that behavior in that situation. I was proud of myself. I didn't lose it. I did the angry mom thing.
Well, I noticed that. And the other thing that struck me, and I look, whatever. I don't try not to get into the drama, but I'll just tell you. I thought that it was weird, especially because I've heard Nick say on his stream that he thinks Dave is disgusting and that he hates him.
Yeah.
And so if someone thought I was disgusting and they hated me, the last thing I'd be doing is fucking licking their balls. And it was some supreme ball washing that was going on. It just was. Objectively, it was.
Yeah, we would fight about that sometimes offline.
I just don't get it, you know?
I don't know. If somebody is like, you're dead to me, I'm like, you're dead to me too. And then I move on.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, please like me, please.
I know. I don't really understand it.
Yeah, it's like battered wife syndrome or something.
No, it's more like it's a daddy thing or something. You think? It's our like leader, our dad, our father. Yeah.
No strong father figure.
No. His dad is actually great. I don't know. I think that once you sacrifice for a cause, you kind of have to go down with the ship. I mean, I don't think you do. You can just admit you're wrong.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Why is that so hard for people?
Well, it's hard for stupid people, I think, because it's like, you know, the stupider you are, the more you have to try to prove that you're not an idiot, you know?
Yeah.
And the more you have at stake and the more angry you get when people call you. Like, if you're actually smart and someone calls you stupid, it's like if you were really hot and someone called you ugly, it wouldn't bother you that much, you know? It's like, you're like, okay, whatever, you know? Like, you would just know that wasn't true. And people that aren't very smart that get called out for not being very smart are the ones that lose their fucking shit. So I think it's something like that. You know, I don't know. Professor Chaos says it seems Nick wants to be the Pope of right wing political discourse. If you have to lick his taint to get the blessing.
Yeah. That's true. There is also a religious element here.
Right.
So like I was on a Telegram group call one time. I think Reinhardt was there. And then Dave told me this was the beginning of the end. Dave told me that Nick is the Holy Spirit speaks through him. And so he's the anointed monarch of the dissident right. And I was like, and so it's like it's blasphemy to speak against the
Lord. Was he joking?
Reinhardt was there. I was not the only person that heard this. So like, I don't want to mischaracterize what he said. So maybe we should ask Reinhardt, but I was like, no. I'm Catholic and that's idolatry, first of all. And
that's crazy.
I was like, absolutely not. Am I going to endow an individual who's not even a cleric, not that I would do it for them either, with like God speaks through them and they have to have that level of respect for me. Like you're in dangerous territory if you're endowing an individual with that level of respect. Like you're in deep.
That's how cults operate 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's total mind raped cult behavior right there.
Yeah.
All right, we got Great Wahiti says, I'm late as hell. Guess I'm Replay Gang, the Central Park Five. Any interest in covering those twisted nigglets?
That story is so fucked up.
Yeah, it comes up from time to time, and I just
didn't you cover it?
No, I haven't.
We gotta cover this on Outlaws.
I've thought about it. Yeah, I mean, maybe we could do it for Outlaws, yeah. because it's one that, like, I know other people have covered in the past, but I think we would probably do a better job.
Yeah. It's so obvious that they did it.
Yeah, from the little research I did, I was like, yeah, okay, they obviously did it. So yeah, that's possible. Then we got Art Stanton says, I'm from Philly. That's a major reason I'm so J-pilled. Exposure to how awful they are at a young age really helps. Well, I'll tell you, his Jewish friends talked about how they were always getting into fights in their Jewish neighborhood in Philly. So there was that part of it, too. All right. And that's all I got on Rumble.
Now to entropy. No, all right. Let me pull up YouTube. Are you good on your whole donation end?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. This is episode 10. Lucian Lachance. Am I saying that incorrectly? I'm sorry if I am. Kudos to Devin's recent epic rant on the insomnia string. Yes, kudos to Devin. You know, sometimes when you get into that like OG Devin zone, it makes me excited for the future, yet also nostalgic. And it's like a really special place for you. It is. Speaking of the ball washing, we're going to glaze Devin over here. Jacob Winkleman, glad it's over for the Mexican. Get active peacefully. I agree with most of that. It's up to the viewer to decide what I disagree with. HWP, missed you guys last week. Great stream as always. All tiny hats into the roofful. Now I agree with all of that for sure. Eggy Jet Pilot, I was talking this week with another military pilot about the U.S. hitting Iran basically for Israel's interests and caught myself thinking, nothing the roofful couldn't fix. Almost randomly laughed when it popped into my head. Yeah. Thank you, Chief Revilo. Jacob Winkleman again. On Dave and Nick, we need to sunset this term, but the way they look out for each other is super brown coated. I like that term. White people have freedom of speech to debate, not to suck up to people with a great vocabulary. Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why we can't just be like, we have disagreements, but we have a common cause. And the only reason that we can't do that is because we don't have a common cause.
Right.
And that's really the problem. El Quakey says, people accuse you of purity spiraling on Nick, but these critics ignore Nick purity spirals on anyone who counter signals his flavor of the week takes. Yeah, he goes just nuclear on people for just minor transgressions. A lot. He does that a lot. And that makes me also suspicious. It's like, you know, I don't think that we should all be getting along irrespective of, you know, these major ideological fissures that we have, but there needs to be some semblance of unity to the degree that it's appropriate.
Right.
Shell Beach. Hey, Devin, have you ever looked into the story of Hurricane Reuben Cater, another famous black martyr? Is that what he means? Who had a movie made about him, who I suspect is full of shit. Hurricane Reuben Cater.
Never heard of that, but I'll add it to my notes here.
Thank you so much. And See Me Rollin', I think, is the last one. Interesting show today, guys. What is the schedule for the Reset Show? I am on with Cameron McGregor every Thursday at noon Pacific Standard Time. Please head over there tomorrow. Donate. Help us get the show off. I mean, we started as this little project just to see how it goes. But I think that there's really something there. Sometimes you just have to start a podcast and then just kind of let it evolve. Let it see if it has teeth. And I'm having a great time doing it. I love having these fun shows with Devin and then doing a serious one the next day. It's really scratching all the itches. But if you haven't checked it out, I do a show called The Reset with Cameron McGregor on my YouTube channel, Blonde of the Belly of the Beast, my second YouTube channel at Rebecca Hargreaves One. We stream it on my Twitter, which is @blondes_tweets. Yeah, it's called The Reset. It's great. It's a fantastic time. We keep it to an hour. It's a nice tight little show. I think I'm good over here. Let me reload.
Okay.
Oh, it's Reuben Carter. That was a typo in the super chat.
All right. I just fixed it. Okay. So you get over there?
Yep. That was the last one.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us on the Outlaws show, and make sure you tune in to the Insomnia stream this Saturday at 10 o'clock Pacific time, PM, of course, for the Insomnia. And as Rebecca just said, her show also,
What's it called, Devin? Have you ever watched it, Devin?
I've seen parts of one.
He doesn't watch this show either. I feel like I'm kind of cheating on both of you.
I just don't watch a lot of shows. It's been a busy month for me, so I just haven't watched a lot of stuff. But I'll check it out. I'll check it out. I guess
it's okay. You don't have to. It's all right.
I'm sure it's wonderful. I'm sure it's everything that you'd want in a show like that.
Thank you all so much. Please remember to buy some books from Antelope Hill, code Outlaws, and check us out next week. We will be back. This is Outlaws. I'm Rebecca Hargraves.
And I'm Devin Stack. You guys have a good rest of your life.
See you later.
Or week. We'll be back.